My name's Tricia Letty, and along with Jeff Sussman, we are the co-chairs of this committee, and we'd like to welcome all of you, and we're going to start with introductions. So in your introductions, if you could do two things. First of all, tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, what your background is, you know, related to this subject or not. And also tell us about your experience in looking at measures of performance measures or this type of measurement work in particular would be of interest. In addition, the most important thing in doing the introductions and for the rest of the day is when you're speaking to push the red button. That is, I should mention that this meeting is being recorded and that the way that the people on the phone, there are three people on the phone that will introduce themselves, and the way that they are hearing us is through the microphone. So let's start with Luke and then end with the staff.
Good morning. I'm Luke Pelletier. I'm a clinical nurse specialist at Sharp Mesa Vista Hospital and core adjunct faculty with National University in San Diego, California. I'm the previous editor-in-chief of the Journal for Healthcare Quality, and I've done a good amount of work with the National Quality Forum on evidence-based treatments for substance use. It's great to be here.
Good morning. I'm Bob Rocha. I am currently the Vice President and Medical Director at Shepherd Pratt in Baltimore, which is a large freestanding psychiatric hospital. I'm also on the part-time faculty at Hopkins and the University of Maryland. In my capacity as a chief medical officer, I'm in charge of the quality program and performance improvement programs for our health system. I've had an interest in developing physician practice profiles for our physicians and have worked on with a number of other people on creating that over the last couple of years to give physicians a doctor-specific feedback on performance in a variety of dimensions. Worked with some members of the Maryland Psychiatric Society and the APA to put a program together at which we arrived at our own tentative set of performance measures, process-oriented performance measures for psychiatrists, and be interested in hearing what some other people might think about what we came up with offline later today. And I have a little bit of experience with the National Quality Forum as a member of a technical advisory panel on a group of measures for inpatient psychiatry that's recently been looked at. And it's great to be here.
Bonnie Zell, Senior Director for Population Health at the National Quality Forum.
Good morning. I'm Rich Goldberg. I'm a psychiatrist from state of Rhode Island. I'm the chief of psychiatry at two of the general hospitals, Brown-affiliated general hospitals. I'm a professor of psychiatry, Brown University, and the chairman of a psychiatry service line over a network of hospitals in the state of Rhode Island, leading really recently a quality initiative that's statewide to develop and implement outcomes measures across our system. We held our recently an inaugural conference for the state in quality and safety and psychiatry and behavioral health. And although I'm personally kind of focused on policy and conceptual issues in quality, we have divisions which are measuring quality outcomes. We have a web-based system of outcomes for our outpatient programs that we track, which, again, looking forward to sharing ours and hearing from other people. And I'm pleased to be part of this initiative. Hope I can contribute something and learn something from others as well.
Good morning. My name is Maureen Hennessy, and I'm a psychologist. I'm also a certified coach with a special interest and expertise in patient engagement and coaching for patient engagement. I'm on the clinical faculty for the medical school at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, and I'm also president of Gardner Health Systems, which is a consulting firm that specializes in wellness and preventive health strategies. And I'm also on the board of directors for Trauma Support Network, which is a national organization focusing on training and engagement in care of individuals who have experienced trauma or who are first responders for people who've had trauma. My background includes working on standards development and measures development for URAC with their consumer-directed health product, their care management and disease management products, and also working with NCQA on a number of different task forces, including preventive health. And I also did some work with IOM on the community initiatives, particularly involving depression, which is one of my special interests. Great to be here.
I'm Harold Pincus. I have a number of different hats, but I'm professor and vice chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia and also director of quality and outcomes research at New York Presbyterian Hospital. I'm also a senior scientist at the RAND Corporation. And I've been involved with a number of different NQF committees and groups. Most recently, I guess, was one on defining patient-centered episodes of treatment for alcoholism, and I before that I co-chaired the Medication Management Measures Steering Committee. I'm also involved with a number of other sort of quality measurement initiatives. I'm the principal investigator of the National Evaluation of the Veterans Administration's Mental Health System, among other things. And I'm glad to be here.
Joel Strime. Internist and geriatric psychiatrist on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania and also at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. Most of my work is in the area of nursing home populations with medical and psychiatric comorbidity and physical disability and looking at clinical outcomes in that population very specifically, both those with cognitive impairment and not. Projects I've been most involved with recently have to do with impairment activity staging, working with colleagues in rehabilitation medicine, looking at predictors of rehab and functional outcomes in elders using large data sets, and also recently was involved in working on revision of the behavior and mood items on the minimum data set that's used in all 16,000 nursing homes across the country, working with Deb Saliba's team, also at RAND. She was at RAND, I'm not. But those are the sorts of things that I'm primarily involved in related to this work.
Good morning. I'm Ann Manton, and I'm a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner at Cape Cod Hospital in psychiatric urgent care. That's a relatively new role for me. Most of my career I have been clinically in the emergency department, and my full-time job for 20-plus years was in academia. And it's from the academic experience that most of my performance measures or outcome criteria have been working at that in terms of student achievement and curriculum appropriateness, et cetera. And this is my first NQF experience, and I'm happy to be here.
I'm Darcy Jaffe, and I am from Harbor View Medical Center in Seattle. I am currently an assistant administrator over psychiatry and behavioral health services. Harbor View is part of the University of Washington Medical Center system. Related to this, I have been on a UHC expert panel looking at outcomes for inpatient psychiatry. I helped out with the Institute for Behavioral Health Care Improvement looking at outcomes for behavioral health and emergency departments. At Harborview, we've been working over the last 10 or 15 years. We have a pretty robust inpatient database for outcomes I'm also working with the Mental Health Integration Project, which is aimed at improving behavioral health care and primary care, and has a web-based tool to be able to track outcomes and patient improvement. And I'm happy to be here, too.
My name is Ashley Morsell. I'm a research analyst at NQF, and I'll be supporting Reva and Ian with the project.
You've probably received emails from Ashley, so you now have a face to go with the email. I'm Reva Winkler. I'm a project consultant for NQF. I've actually been at NQF for almost 9 years now, overseeing many of the projects we do. And as we'll talk about later, this particular effort around mental health is part of a larger outcomes project that I oversee with the rest of the staff. So welcome, and you'll be hearing a lot from me more later.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you guys for all traveling down here. We greatly appreciate it. My name is Ian Corbridge. I'm the project manager for the Mental Health Outcomes Project. I guess I have a background as an RN working in mental health, so it's obviously very something that's close and important to myself. So, and I'll be here working with you guys, and let me know if there's anything I can do to help facilitate the process for you. Do you want to open it up to the individuals on the phone at the time? I guess, Dr. Gopuru, would you like to start off introducing yourself?
Sure. My name is Dan Coffer. I'm a neurologist at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm certified in behavioral neurology and neuropsychiatry as an integrated subspecialty. I run the memory disorders program here. My experience related to this meeting has to do with being on the technical expert panel for a couple of reviews, one on drug treatment for Alzheimer's, another on prevention of Alzheimer's disease. I've also been very involved with the behavioral neurology section of the American Academy of Neurology in working on developing quality measures and standards for diagnosing and treating dementia, which is my primary interest in this context here.
This is Eric Goplerud. I'm a research professor at George Washington University and direct the Center for Integrated Behavioral Health Policy here at GW. My past experience with NQF has been to chair the technical advisory panel for a project on substance abuse evidence-based practices. Harold Pincus was on a recent panel on substance abuse episodes of care for, 13, 14 years. I was on the NCQA Behaviors Measures Advisory Panel and have a long-standing interest and involvement in performance measurement.
Yeah, I'm Bill Golden, and I am a professor of medicine and public health at University of Arkansas. Also, I'm on the call today as the medical director for health policy at Arkansas Medicaid. I have been a former board member of NQF and have been developing performance measures for the last 17 years. Currently sit on the AMA TCPI and have co-chaired many of their committees. I also co-chaired an independent committee that developed performance measures for bipolar disease, which actually several of which have been NQF approved. Long ago and far away, I was actually on the original AHCPR guideline development panel for depression and primary care. I'm really interested. There's a desperate need in Medicaid for mental health measures. It's a substantial comorbidity and issue in that population.
Hi, this is Carol Wilkins. I'm currently an independent consultant, but I was until a few weeks ago the director of public policy and research for the Corporation for Supportive Housing. And this is my first experience with NQF, but I guess the experience that I bring that's most relevant is a lot of work looking at the relationship between homelessness and housing status and both the utilization and cost of health services, particularly among people who are frequent users of emergency health services, and more appropriate utilization of services that seem to reflect changes in quality outcomes. I've been responsible for coordinating or gathering and synthesizing and sharing a lot of the evidence about the effectiveness of housing-based multidisciplinary service models for people who are homeless or unstably housed and often have co-occurring mental health, substance abuse, and chronic health conditions. And I'll be traveling to join the group in person tomorrow.
Is there anybody else on the line? Okay, well, I'm Jeff Sussman. I'm the Chair of Family Medicine at the University of Cincinnati. My research interest is in primary care and behavioral health, particularly developing a grounded theory of depression care and interventions that are based on the real world of primary care. From a NQF point of view, I've been our member representative to the National Quality Forum and have worked on the behavioral health TAP in the past. I've also been involved with NCQA and a number of the other sort of measure-setting, measure-vetting fora. My interest in quality measurement also extends to home, where the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has funded a series of 15 communities to improve care and its aligning forces for quality, and I head the quality measurement and public reporting work group and physician liaison group, which makes for interesting conversations at 8 o'clock in the morning. Finally, I've been working recently with the PCPCC Behavioral Health Task Force, which is how do we integrate behavioral health into the patient-centered medical home. And one of the challenges, I think, with the existing NCQA criteria is that there isn't really overt recognition of behavioral health's importance within the NCQA scoring criteria. So hopefully we can bring some of that from our National Academy perspective. I'm on the Commission for Quality and Practice and am the editor for our and medical director for our METRIC project, which is a quality improvement project aimed at practicing clinicians throughout the U.S. and our membership. So it's a real pleasure to be here. I appreciate the expertise and diverse perspectives we have. I think it's going to be a real exciting couple of days. So thank you all for attending.
I'm Tricia Letty. Didn't follow my own instructions about pushing the red button. I'm a senior health policy advisor for our director of health. I am right now in charge of reviewing requests for hospital mergers. So that's been my world for the past almost a year. Previous to that, when hospitals were not asking to merge, I was the deputy director of our mental health department. So I've been in state service quite a few years. So I did that only for 2 years, and before that I developed and ran our Medicaid managed care program called Right Care. Most of my experience is Medicaid, and while in Medicaid, developed performance-based contracts with health plans, did a lot of work with developing measures as part of that we could use for actual payment, and then the health plans paying the physician practices for certain measures, mostly using HEDIS measures, of which there are only a couple of mental health measures. But also in my role in Medicaid, I developed across the entire Medicaid program a research and evaluation component in collaboration with Brown University, where we developed health outcome measures for each of our Medicaid populations and then set up a measurement, a system of measuring those health outcome measures each year and use them really to change the program. So in Medicaid, I used outcomes not only for quality improvement on the health plan or provider level, but also for ourselves as a program in defining the contracts and what is in the contracts with health plans or what is in the benefit package. So that's where we could use measures that really looked at the entire Medicaid population
and how they were doing, and develop program improvements to address anything that was not showing improvement or was a problem in accordance with baseline. So I would also like to welcome everybody. This is my first National Quality Forum Task Force. A lot of people have been on National Quality Forum Task Forces before. And now we're going to have the introductions Helen is going to introduce herself and provide an overview of the project.
If I could just have one question, is there a way to get on the internet faster?
No. I tried.
The answer would be no.
No, I did the password thing, and I can't get on here, so it's not I think it's the basement.
If someone has an urgent need and is actually physically present here, I do have a satellite card and certainly can share that.
It's been a good portion of days, like rats seeking light up the escalators,
yeah.
As I just did it about 5 of 10, so apologies. This is always a difficult hotel.
We have some here, actually, in a pen drive, or it would be in your email. So if you'd like in a pen drive, I have it right here.
So those of you who need the materials or only got gobbledygook when you tried to raise them up, just let Ian know.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Helen Burstyn. I'm the Senior Vice President of Performance Measures at NQF, and thank you for being with us, and thanks to those on the phone. I know it's always difficult to not have the visuals, but appreciate your input. Weaver will run through the larger vision of this specific part of the project, but just want to at least add my welcome and emphasize how important this particular project is for us. Really, the chance to finally get to focus strongly on outcomes measurement is something we've said we wanted to do for a long time, trying to move the field more away, not as closely aligned to just process for the sake of process, but at least process measures that have a closer link to outcomes and ultimately, we hoped, outcomes. So we really, when we got the initial list of the top 20 conditions that Reva will go over with you, just really thought it made a lot of sense to pull this particular group out for some further discussion, since I think there are some really important, unique issues around mental health outcomes. And we did include in here some of the memory disorders and Alzheimer's, for example, as being, we wanted to think very broadly about the kind of mental health scope that we're going to ask you to help us think through. But this project is also a little unusual in that we've staged it such that you're going to essentially help us write the call for measures, as Reva will go over with you. We thought it was premature for us to do a call for measures and then get in some things that maybe would seem appropriate or not appropriate, not the right scope, too broad, too limited. So you're really going to have a chance over the next couple of days to help us set that scope. We'll then do the call for measures, and you'll have plenty of opportunity to engage in the usual NQF activities of reviewing and evaluating the measures for their strength and our four criteria, as Reva will go over with you. But just want to add my thank you, and I'll be here with you in and out over the next couple of days, but you're in great hands with this team.
Thanks, everybody, and welcome to all of you. Certainly in hearing the introductions, what I hear is a wide variety of experience with NQF. So we really want to try and bring you all to the same place. And so what I'm going to try and do initially is give you an overview of NQF's operations, organization, and current activities, because everything we do, we try and keep sight of all the various activities within any particular project so that everything remains somewhat of an integrated whole. So for those of you who are very familiar, and this is repetitive, I apologize in advance, but for those of you who haven't a great deal of experience with this, I think it will help provide the context of what NQF is as an organization, as well as then we'll get into the details of the project. NQF is an organization that began 10 years ago. We just celebrated our 10th year anniversary. There has been a lot of evolution in NQF. I've been here for 9 of those 10 years. We are a private, nonprofit, voluntary consensus standard setting organization, and that mouthful actually has some a very specific meaning, because the formal process of the consensus development process does comport to federal law, and that gives it a certain amount of standing with the federal government. And it is why we adhere very closely to that formal process that we'll describe to you later. We are a membership organization. We have over 400 members. It's a very diverse stakeholder membership. That's very deliberate. We really want to bring in all sorts of perspectives around the healthcare table. Those members are organized into 8 stakeholder councils that include, and I'm not going to try and hit all 8 of them, but consumers and purchasers, as well as health plan, health professionals, community and public health agencies, provider groups. So, you know, just about anybody you can think of fits in one of our stakeholder councils, and that is very deliberate. And as we'll talk about, a steering committee is meant to be a proxy for that membership, so you'll find the same kind of diversity of membership around the steering committee. NQF structure is typical of a nonprofit organization. We are overseen by the board of directors. They have organized a subcommittee of the board to actually assist them in the work of providing the final endorsement of the measures that we do endorse as consensus standard, voluntary consensus standards. That is a fairly significant workload, so they created a subcommittee to help them do that. We also work very closely as a member of the National Priorities Partnership, which some of you may have heard about or been involved with, and we'll talk a little bit more about who they are. And then we also have our leadership network, which is comprised of the chairs and vice chairs of all of the stakeholder councils to provide leadership among our membership and input and communication among all the various activities within NQF. So we are a growing organization and a fair amount of activities ongoing. We'll just kind of touch on a few of them. One thing I'd like to draw your attention to is NQF's website at www.qualityforum.org. This past summer, we have revised and upgraded our website. There is an awful lot of information here. I would strongly recommend that all of you go to the website and actually enroll for an account. Absolutely anybody can. No membership requirements at all, because that will allow you to tailor your own dashboard so that you can, once you log in, have the things of interest to you come up so readily available, such as this project or some of the other activities that NQF is engaged in. If another way to access information about this project is under the tab Measuring Performance. If you drop down to Consensus Development Projects, this is certainly one of them. You'll also see the wide variety of consensus development projects that NQF is got ongoing at this time. So there's an awful lot of activity, and I would strongly recommend that you do enroll and check in with the website. You will find that most of the information around this project will be posted. As Tricia mentioned, the recording and the transcript of this meeting will be posted on the project website, all of the documents, all this stuff. So it can be a very good reference source of where documents and information is located as the project progresses. NQF has a 3-pronged mission. One is improving the quality of American healthcare by setting national priorities and goals for performance improvement. The second one is endorsing national consensus standards for measuring and public reporting on performance. And that's really the area that this particular effort is addressing. And that, as well, we have an educational arm to promote the attainment of those national goals and use of the performance measures. As I mentioned, NQF is now 10 years old. Some of you have been with us and involved in some of our activities through a lot of that time frame. There has been a lot of evolution, both in the quality measurement enterprise, all of the organizations that contribute to that work, all of our members, the actual work that we do, the criteria we use to evaluate measures. We have certainly seen performance improvement and evolution in the work that NQF does. Certainly, there is, over time, been a drive towards higher performance, both expectations of the measures and the quality of the measures and the robustness of the measures to raise the bar, if you will, to help drive further and higher performance. Shifting towards composite measures, the idea of composite measures that bring together different aspects of performance in a summary is very useful for a lot of our stakeholders, as well as it's just a different way to look at performance, whether all things have been accomplished in the care of a patient rather than piecemeal one at a time. Another one of the focus areas that we really want all of our projects to attend to is looking at disparities. How can we measure disparities? How might measurement of disparities be appropriate for whatever the topic of an individual project is? So keeping an awareness of disparities in everything we do is certainly a priority. Over the course of the last 10 years, NQF has endorsed over 500 measures, and certainly we've evaluated many, many, many more. Certainly over that time, we've looked at many measures that are very similar. Measures are developed by a variety of folks for their own purposes and get brought to NQF. And so we see measures that are either addressing the same focus of care or the same outcome of care. They all seem to be slightly different. It's a little bit different in the coding, a little bit different in the specification. Not a lot, but a little bit. And certainly the end users have told us over and over again that having measures addressing the same thing, being a little bit different, is not helpful out there. It makes it very difficult to implement and to not have them aligned in a way that facilitates implementation means they aren't as likely to get implemented. So harmonization has become a real significant priority, looking at the specifications of measures for things like age inclusions. Looking at what does it mean to, you know, measure diabetics. Well, how do you define it so that they all capture the same thing? There are times when the specification of the measure is appropriate to be different, but if not, to try and get them as aligned as possible. As we're evolving and asking more and more of measurement and quality improvement, we want to try to promote shared accountability in measurement and particularly across patient-focused episodes of care, get us out of the silos, follow the real patients. For a patient, their experience is not just within the hospital, not just within long-term care, not just at home. They often, spend time in all of those arenas. And so patient-focused episodes of care is a place we need to evolve to. And in doing so, greater focus on outcome measures, which is what this project is doing, is really looking at outcome measures because all of the elements that contribute to patient outcomes in all the different settings and all of the different caregivers are important to capture. We also want to start looking at appropriateness measures. Not only was the care efficacious, but was it appropriate, even if well done? And then cost and resource measures coupled with quality to look at efficiency. NQF will be embarking on a project that will stage somewhat behind this project, looking at cost or resource use measures that once these two projects are finished, hopefully we'll start to have the building blocks to build some of these these quality aligned with cost resource measures to measure efficiency. So there's just an awful lot of activity going on that everything is interrelated, and it's our job on the staff to try and keep you aware of all the things and keep ourselves aware of where we do interact with all of the other staff members within NQF's organization. NQF strategic goals, as any organization has them with their mission and goals, we essentially, our goal is to be the principal body that endorses national healthcare performance measures and quality indicators. By doing so, increase the demand for high-quality healthcare and be recognized as a major driving force and facilitator for quality improvement within the healthcare arena. So, as I mentioned, over the 10 years of NQF's existence, we've certainly seen a growth of NQF-endorsed measures, and I mentioned that 500 is going to be 600 very soon. We certainly have an expanded set of measures, and there have been several drivers for that large set. As adoption of measures for different types of incentive programs, such as the pay-for-reporting or pay-for-performance programs, there have been a great needs for either the federal government or various payers. Measures at the individual physician level. This has been the area I've worked on primarily over the last several years, particularly around physician-level measurement in ambulatory and inpatient care. Measures that we've mentioned disparity-sensitive. We try and identify those measures that are particularly important and sensitive to disparities such that with the appropriate stratification we could have a better, more information, better understanding about disparities in certain topic areas. measuring patient experience or surrogate experiences of the care that's given in a variety of settings, an important thing. Cross-cutting areas that, regardless of the topic, condition, illness, or reason for interacting with the healthcare system, there are just certain things that are relatively cross-cutting. Patient safety issues, medication issues, those sorts of things. So right now, and rather all the time, there are several key issues for the NQF portfolio of measures. You know, we constantly have to ask, do we have too many, too few, or do we have the right measures? And I think that the NQF portfolio is not something that's static. It's an evolutionary thing. The measures, for the most part, that are endorsed are, the plan is to have a three-year maintenance review, and some measures just will have outlived their usefulness, have been superseded by better and more robust measures over time. As we move to having more outcome measures, perhaps we need fewer process measures, or perhaps we need composite process measures rather than individual ones. So this evolution is something that's ongoing, and I'm not sure the answer is too many or too few, but the answer is what are the right measures. And again, over time that will change. So it is not a static portfolio. One of the benefits of going to the NQF website that I showed you earlier is that you can search for the NQF endorsed measures. And you can search by a variety of criteria and find out what may be available in your area of interest. Another key issue on the within the NQF endorsed measures is the availability of data sources. And data sources is certainly one of the challenging aspects of measures. What we are seeing, however, are new data sources or more mature or more methodologically challenging answers to data management that are allowing us to combine data sources to create measures that weren't available before. This also includes transitions to EHRs and pulling in data from multiple sources using health information exchanges. So a lot of sort of evolution is occurring on the data front as well, and becoming more sophisticated and the methodologies being able to address some of the data challenges that were not available to us previously. So all of these things are the context within which we'll be working as we try and identify appropriate outcome measures for this topic area. Just mentioning quality measurement and disparities again, a focus. NQF prefers to identify measures that are sensitive to disparities and be able to stratify them out to break out the different populations so we can get information on disparities. Again, the challenges of collecting the appropriate information to be able to do that are well known, but continuing to push for that data capability is something we don't want to overlook. We mentioned episodes of care. And I'd like to share with you another bit of work that NQF is doing around the episode of care framework. This is a series of work that NQF has done over the last 2 years, starting with a framework for what is an episode of care. And some of you perhaps have seen our bubble diagrams, as they are often called. I certainly have been in the audience at other meetings and seen our bubble diagrams being used. This is an example of the episode framework as applied to coronary artery disease and acute MI, where you look at the population at risk, you look at acute phase treatments, post-acute rehab, and then secondary prevention, with several different trajectories for a patient's course of care with different outcomes. As you can see on the right-hand side, the kinds of outcomes of interest, including functional status, quality of life, secondary prevention, rehab, and then advanced care planning. So those are the kinds of outcomes steering committee or the, I forget what we called the committee that helped pull this together for acute MI. But you can see that the episode of care begins with the onset of acute symptoms, extends for a year post the acute MI, and there are two different trajectories. So we are going through a series of different topics and applying the framework. Some of you mentioned last week having been involved in the one for substance use. We've also done episode frameworks on diabetes and cancer, and I'm trying to remember what else. Oh, low back pain. That's it, low back pain. So this is something that's continuing, and as we're hoping to do a little bit more of this work in another part of the Outcomes Project with some of our technical advisory panels, as we're trying to ask the question, what are the appropriate outcomes that of interest for the various conditions that have been identified for this big project? But this is an example of what we mean by an episode of care. As you can see, it crosses care settings and really is focused on what the patient experiences. We mentioned that one of NQF's missions is to establish national priorities and goals, and certainly there are a need for some prioritization. There is a lot of activity around performance measurement, lots of organizations involved, and trying to prioritize those efforts to collectively get a greater push out of the results than everyone going their own way. Aligning those efforts and hoping to accelerate them is a goal for which the National Priorities Partnership was constituted 2 years ago, I think it was. 32 leadership organizations, and you could probably come up with the list, but you could take a look at the list on the NQF website, as well as I'll show you the website for the National Priorities Partnership. This organization is co-chaired by Don Berwick from IHI and Peggy O'Kane from NCQA. And this is an effort around these organizations to focus in on six identified priorities, which I'll go over with you in a minute, to align the efforts of all of these organizations around some common priorities and goals. Selecting the priorities and goals were around trying to get the biggest bang for the buck. They tried to find the overlapping areas around effectiveness, patient safety, disparities, and wastefulness, and found the high-impact areas. The national priorities and goals are six, and just briefly, care coordination is one. You know, looking at medication reconciliation, looking at preventable hospital readmissions and ED visits. The second one is improving the health of the population, population health, and you're going to hear later from Dr. Bonnie Zell, who's just recently joined NQF staff to lead our population health work, and with focus around preventive services, healthy lifestyle behaviors, and ultimately to find a way of developing a population and community health index. And so Bonnie's going to tell you a little bit more about how we might be approaching that, particularly with an eye towards the contributions of mental health. The third priority is patient safety. This has certainly been sort of one of the main focuses of NQF's activities over the last 10 years, improving safety and reliability, looking at hospital-level mortality rates, looking at serious adverse events. You're probably familiar with the work NQF has done over the years in serious reportable events and the safe practices, looking at healthcare-associated infections. So these are important priorities and goals. The last three are, and none of these are in no particular order, engaging patients and families in managing care, so informed decision-making, patient experience with care, and patient self-management. And these are important areas that I think we may be touching on in this particular topic area. Another priority is around appropriate and compassionate care for life-limiting illnesses, end-of-life care, palliative care, around both symptom and psychosocial and spiritual needs, as well as communication and support for families. And then the last one is really the appropriate use of healthcare services to eliminate waste while ensuring the delivery of appropriate care. This one always seems to be a hot topic. So the potential areas of overuse that the National Priorities Partnership has identified are around medication use, lab testing, diagnostic procedures, maternity care, consultations, U.S. Preventive Services Task Force D-list preventive services, as well as preventable hospitalizations, ED visits, and non-palliative end-of-life care. So lots of potential areas, and this is a focus, I think, of a lot of work in all aspects of what NQF is doing. While NQF is very much involved in convening and one of the 32 national priorities partners, it is a separate organization, if you will, and has its own website. So feel free to check out www.nationalpriorityspartnership.org, and you'll get a great deal more information about who the priority partners are, their meetings, the issues around each of the priorities and goals, and just the work that's going on with this group. We keep an eye on what's going on with the National Priorities Partnership because all of NQF's activities as a good partner within that organization is focused in on aligning and adding our work and aligning our work with the rest of the partners. So as we try and align all the various activities, this is the episode of Care Framework with the National Priorities Partners. Goals and priorities. So we keep trying to align and build on things. So just keep in mind we don't want to ignore all these various activities that are important to NQF. Another aspect, we're on slide 19 for those of you on the phone, is the health IT landscape. Health information technology and the evolution, the stimulus to more use of EHRs is something that NQF is very much involved in. We have a department that, a growing small department, that is working on quite a few projects around some of the challenges of adoption of EHR, particularly as a useful tool for performance measures, as well as to support the incentives for more use and uptake of EHRs out in, by clinicians. So the work that NQF is doing is working around accelerating those efforts, helping work with others on the challenges of getting the right information within the EHR and characterize the data fields appropriately so it can be used for performance measurement, as well as working with the all of the stimulus activities around the AARA, particularly around meaningful use and some of the other issues around EHR development. The challenges around data we've already touched on, I think, a bit, but again, the health information technology capabilities need to be integrated, need to be brought together. There's just a lot going on out there. So NQF is very much involved in all of these spheres, and it's challenging to keep up with what's happening over on that side of the house, actually. But we do our best, and we use Helen to keep us honest and be the messenger between all those activities. One of the more important activities around for performance measure lately is the most recent NQF Health IT Expert Panel has created what's known as the Quality Data Set. What NQF staff did last spring and summer was look through all the endorsed NQF measures and identify the actual data elements it would take to construct those measures, and created a data set called the Quality Data Set that describes what those data elements are and what the type of data needed to support the quality measurement and the flow. The IT folks are continuing to work with the quality data set to look how that would be integrated within an EHR environment and to incorporate it with actually the workflow within a practice. From this, which is ever-growing as we keep endorsing measures, the idea, the next step is to develop a measure authoring tool such that we can standardize the data types and the data elements needed so that the definition for a measure about patients with diabetes will have a common denominator. There will be a standard way of specifying it and defining it and identifying the data elements needed. We don't have to keep doing that, each group doing their own thing and being slightly different. So this promotes standardization, harmonization, as well as incorporating it into the EHR, kind of all in one activity. So this is something that is rapidly growing, and I believe we just released the quality data set for comment. Oh, it's done. So we've released it for as the final report, and you can get more information on that on our website. So there's just a lot of different activities that all interrelate around what NQF is doing, and it's a busy place. Right now, I think I'd like to stop and just entertain any questions you might have about what NQF is doing in general around any of the things I've mentioned or anything else that you'd like to ask.
Maybe at the break here we could introduce our two new members of the group who have walked in, and that'll give you all a chance to absorb the 350 slides and tour of NQF that we've had. Maybe Sheila, would you like to start?
Sure. In your introduction, in addition to introducing yourself, especially talk about your experience with measurement.
Okay. And you have to use the microphone, the dreaded red light here.
How's that? I passed the first test. I apologize.
Excellent.
For being late. My travel, I come from Kentucky. I traveled up from Lexington today, and we don't have a metro in Kentucky, so it took me a little longer than the 30 minutes I planned. So anyway, it's a pleasure to be here. I have an academic appointment in the College of Pharmacy at the University of Kentucky, and I specialize in mental health. And so as a part of my job, I practice in the VA setting in mental health, providing direct patient care and medication management. I do research in that setting as well, largely focused on adherence and specifically in PTSD at this moment. Another portion of my job as a faculty member is working with our policy and outcomes or research group, or we have a sort of a core group within our college, largely working with Kentucky Medicaid. And so I've done work in schizophrenia and depression, and have a real interest in outcome measures of both of those, and particularly as they affect rural health populations and those specific cultures in the Appalachian region.
Hi, good morning. My name is George Wan, and I'm from Johnson & Johnson, and I'm a epidemiologist and health services researcher by training. I'm currently the outcomes research leader for the CNS franchises as well as immunology at J&J North America Pharmaceuticals. Our focus in the clinical development area, we focus on three primary areas of research in the neurosciences, which includes mood disorders, psychoses, and cognition. And prior to joining industry, I worked as a research analyst at the Medicare Peer Review Organization for the state of Virginia, which are now the Quality Improvement Organizations, and as well as working as a consultant at the BJC Health Systems Center for Quality Management. And just to tie that into some of the industry support that we provided, at McNeil, which is a Johnson & Johnson company, we provided grant funding for the development of the ADHD quality management or quality of care indicator for HEDIS.
Thank you very much. Now, for your questions about anything you wanted to know about NQF but were afraid to ask.
So you mentioned that data sources are a main concern, and I see them as one of the big obstacles to the whole NQF enterprise. As health systems are developing their electronic health records, and as payers are developing their databases for measurement and payment, what kind of coordination, if any, is there? I see all these things evolving sort of in parallel, but how much crosstalk is there? How much do they look to NQF's recently released sort of definitions and guidelines?
That's an excellent question, Joel. I'll take that one. Lisa gives me that look. I know this one's mine. the world has evolved so quickly with the release of ARA. I mean, that whole focus on $40 billion going out the door, I think, has changed the universe in a way that I think most of us thought would take at least another 5 years. So there is now a great deal of attention. NQF works very closely with the Office of the National Coordinator, with CMS and others. We're in the process right now, for example, of retooling, as we're calling it, taking a measure that's currently constructed using a variety of other data sources and retooling it for electronic health records based on the data elements within the quality data set, working closely with health systems and others to say, okay, if you're going to make an investment in an EHR coming up, you're going to want to have an EHR that is going to be certified, and that whole, again, so much of this is an evolution, we'll find out about the certification requirements to follow. But to achieve meaningful use, one of the requirements is you have to have the capacity to transmit quality data. Quality results. And so a lot of our work has been trying to intersect all those various players as they come up with these certification requirements. The Health IT Standards Panel and the Office of the National Coordinator has looked to this quality data set of saying, if one of the requirements is you have to be able to transmit quality measures, you have to make sure you have an EHR that can incorporate these data elements. So there's a lot of sort of knitting together that's happening very, very rapidly, but we're expecting to see this first set of measures that may be used to assess meaningful use being retooled and approved within the next 6 months. Most of those are currently NQF-endorsed measures, and in fact, the measures that are going forward beyond that for 2013 and 2015 align very closely with the national priorities and goals that Reva went over with you. So there's a strong focus on care coordination, for example. So we're going to continue to try to align our work to make sure that what we're putting out is actually what people need to be able to achieve those goals. But it's a great question.
Thank you.
Yeah, just maybe following up on that, you know, as important as it is to align people around the EHR, I think in the short run, next couple of years, we really need to have realignment of what the payers are paying for to change anything. I think that's one of our biggest obstacles, is that we have some ideas, you know, some of how to evolve this, and we're frustrated because they're paying for other things. So, by way of education, starting out with NQF here, what's the involvement of the major payers in this? I don't think one is around the table right now, so maybe you can explain to me how we're interacting with some of the national payers and how this will help them be more aware of the need to realign some of the payment mechanisms, not just Medicaid. There's other and Medicare. There's other payers we're dealing with, too.
Just mention that most of the major health plans and large purchasers are members of NQF and are very engaged. In fact, the board is consumer purchaser majority, quite intentionally, as is the Consensus Standards Approval Committee. I'm back and forth to San Francisco in a day this weekend. I'm still sort of recovering the CSAC. And so we do spend a lot of time doing that. We are not directly involved, obviously, in what things get paid for. But it's not a surprise if there's a specific measure on the quality of something, you might think it might have an expected impact on them. So I think that this work should have an impact there. And I think if there are specific elements that are currently not paid for, where a performance measure would be very useful, that might be an important indicator.
Yeah, Reva, you made the comment that NQF is moving toward composite measures. Could you say a little bit more about what that means?
As we're raising the bar, there is a great deal of interest that we hear from all points within the NQF membership, and certainly as we go through the process, of needing to have more robust measures. Certainly, composite measures, there's a variety of types. We actually, over the last 2 years, have had some steering committees look at measure evaluation criteria for composite measures, acknowledging that individual measures could be combined in any number of ways. You can add them up, you can weight them, you can do any number of combination. Certainly, we hear a great deal from our members, and it was a discussion at last week's CSAC meeting about measures of perfect care, if you will, sort of the all or none measure. If there are five processes that should be done all paid, rather than an individual measure for each of those processes, ask the question, what percentage of your patients got all five? And that takes that becomes a very different question, and for measures that may seem to be doing pretty well and hovering in the high, suddenly asking the question differently realize, maybe we're not doing as well as we thought we were. So there is a great deal of interest in those. And I think there is more development of those types of measures happening. Certainly the feedback from more recent steering committees and CSAC to measure developers has really, you know, made that clear that those are the type of measures that as well as others, but would be very desirable rather than having just series of process measures and having, you know, just lots of measures, have them be combined concepts around more holistic patient care. So all of our calls for measures now are open to not only just individual measures, but composite measures. And a good composite measure is highly desirable as we move forward into more robust measures. So, did that answer your question?
Just to give an example, in Cincinnati, we're looking at diabetes improvement and have a D5, which includes LDL, A1C, blood pressure, smoking, and aspirin use. And, you know, on the individual measures, it might be 70-80%, but the D5 composite in the typical practice is around 15%. So really striving for that level of perfection, if you will, is challenging. Even in Minnesota, where this has been rolled out for about 3 years, they're around 19% or so.
I guess two questions. One is coming back to the issues around IT. Actually, both Helen and I testified just a couple of weeks ago at the National Coordinators, sort of coordinating committee, sort of coordinating twice, a policy committee. And there are clearly, and it relates to sort of our task, because there are clearly some ways by which the mental health field is well behind in terms of the capacity to utilize some of the information technology on a widespread basis, and also the ways in which the ARIS stuff also is more limiting for mental health. So one question is how, you know, as NQF is sort of thinking about, you know, dealing with some of the changes brought on by this influx of resources and applying sort of more thinking about health information technology, how does mental health fit into it? And I have a second question, which has to goes back to the episode-based care thing that may be relevant as we get further into our task, but I still have a hard time, even though I was at the meeting that was focusing on episode-based care for alcohol use disorders, of how it actually would get used, and particularly how it actually would get used in the context of some of the outcome measurement stuff that we're going to be talking about.
So on the first piece, it's important to note that when the quality data set was assembled of what are those key data elements that should be part of all electronic health records for quality measurement, it was built on the basis of the 500 some odd quality measures NQF has endorsed. So there's a bit of a, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy here. There's not a whole lot of data elements for mental health. But the good news is it's supposed to be an iterative quality data set. So we're also helping as these measures come through, some of those key data elements will get added. But again, some of the concepts are still there. Active medication use, active diagnoses, some of these should be translatable. But if there are specific and unique issues that you think won't get captured, and one of my personal concerns is somebody who still sees patients half day a week is a lot of that mental health stuff sometimes isn't in the EHR. And so the question is, how do some of those privacy concerns come through, and how do we get that connectivity to ensure we have that information in an environment that people are comfortable in terms of ensuring privacy? But from that point of view, I think you guys will help build a quality data set for the mental health field that we don't necessarily have those right elements. In terms of how you actually ultimately use this episode-based framework, I think we're just beginning to see that. I think if you look towards some of the proposals that are being looked at currently around health reform, for example, there is some discussion of being, you know, doing bundled payments for the acute illness plus 30 days, for example. Thinking about the quality measures you would use to assess that acute phase may be different than the ones you might just use to assess the in-hospital care. So I think that, you know, some of that will evolve, but if you look at some of the resource use measures, for example, a lot of those on the chronic illness side look at care across 1 year. Is that the right approach for mental health? Should there be other potential approaches? What would episodes look like differently? So that if you wanted to understand outcomes, again, I'm a general internist, not a psychiatrist, but certainly you could think about how perhaps you know, how often somebody gets readmitted in the course of a one-year period, depending on somebody's if they have serious mental illness versus, you know, low-grade depression. Those may be very different kind of episodes than they would be certainly for somebody who I would tend to see with diabetes. But it's just being worked out. But I think the idea is to begin to understand how you can have measures that get us out of our silos. So many of our measures are, this happened in the, like you just looked at those inpatient psych measures. This happened inside an inpatient psych hospital, but very little connection to what we could have done on the outpatient side to prevent that in the first place or improve adherence in the work Sheila does, trying to think about different approaches. And without being able to connect the dots between those different silos of measures, it's hard to get that comprehensive picture that allows us to really improve care.
Coming back to our task, I mean, when the slide that shows it, it laid out sort of one set of outcome measures. You know, if you look at the AMI one, and the question I have is there an expectation that there would be different outcome measures at different phases that would be tied to it? And so it's part of our task also to think about the outcome measures that might be appropriate sort of at the acute phase or the, you know, initial post-hospital phase as compared to the more maintenance phase.
Again, I think you're the clinical expert. I think it should be driven by what makes sense clinically.
Okay.
So I think what we're going to find, as we had discussed this with our instructions for the meeting, is that there's a relative paucity of outcome measures currently, and it's one of our tasks to sort of think big about what should this look like in a more idealized world. Where would the outcome measures be utilized? How would they be utilized? And, you know, we'll have to at some point get down to the fact that there's a gap between the reality of today, but we should be thinking about what would be ideal. We should really be pushing ourselves to move care forward rather than, well, we can't do that because we don't capture that data today.
Can I make a brief comment or question?
Please do.
Yeah, this is Bill Golden. Two areas that I have interest in or hope maybe we could get into would be outcomes of outpatient management of children with mental illness. That's a huge need for Medicaid programs to begin to measure what they're purchasing. And the other thing to think about that goes beyond the episode of the mental illness per se is the impact of better management of mental illness on the management of comorbid diseases. So I have looked at the data in our state, and we have a large number of hospitalizations in patients who have comorbid psychiatric disease, and it's a good chance that the comorbid diseases we better manage if the mental illness is also managed.
I'll just say that we raised those issues as well, and one of the challenges here is to really connect the dots. First of all, with populations, we have a lot of crossover with the childhood origins of mental health issues, particularly serious mental illnesses, and then on the connection between mental health and, the medical side, if you will, there's really an arbitrary distinction there that I think this group should really be working to take down those walls, because we all know how important and bidirectional those influences are. Any other questions?
I just wanted to get NQF's at least perspective on, you know, certain measures that may not necessarily be clearly defined patient health outcomes measures. They may be more the process structure types of parameters. For instance, medication adherence would be one. The other one would be frequency of follow-up care or rehospitalization. And so these are known indicators of quality, but would these be parameters within our kind of peer review for discussion?
One of the topics we're going to hopefully spend a fair amount of time on later is we've got a proposed list of the types of outcome measures, and you're going to help decide if indeed you would include them as outcome measures or not, or refine them and be more specific for the mental health world. So we've found with our, we'll tell you more about the fact that this big outcomes project has several other components to it, and the other steering committees are finding they like it big. And so the opportunity to include, you know, other outcomes, intermediate outcomes, functional outcomes, medication adherence actually is one that is typically included. You'll have that opportunity to help us. And that's what we call setting the scope. And so you'll set the boundaries around it for us. And we'll work together to do that this afternoon.
Maybe that's a good transition to the second part of our orientation, the Outcomes Project. Ian, are you going to take that?
Yes, I don't know. We're a little bit ahead of schedule. I don't know if people want to get up, stretch, or grab a coffee, or are you guys ready to go? Looks like we'll move forward then.
Two minutes stretch.
I'm all for that, so.
Yeah, thanks. Those of you online can catch up on your email.
Okay.
We're going to resume on slide number 23 on your slide set and tell you a little bit more about this particular project. As I alluded to earlier, the Outcomes Project is a rather large project. The mental health component is only one part of it. The entire project is funded by the Department of Health and Human Services. They have an interest in pushing outcome measures, identifying outcome measures, particularly around the top 20 Medicare conditions. And so that was their focus. They were amenable to including, for us, adding child health, but the 20 top Medicare conditions include depression and other serious mental illnesses and Alzheimer's and related conditions. So in organizing this project, it seemed that the child health and the mental health components had special characteristics that suited having separate steering committees to look at the special issues around those topic areas. Now, this is the third steering committee meeting for this outcomes project. The main steering committee, the child health steering committee have already met. We're certainly seeing overlap. The boundaries are not hard and fast. It will very much depend on the measures that come forward. If we've got, you know, measures that both are child and mental health, we may have to figure out how to put you guys together and work that through. If we don't have any, then that's not an issue we have to grapple with. So we are very much aware of the crossover and the fuzzy edges between these. But it does allow child health and mental health to have kind of focuses of their own. This whole project is meant to be big, expansive. We want both cross-cutting types of measures, either for your entire population or your entire population with X condition, as well as condition-specific outcomes. But we are focused in on outcomes. Within the NQF portfolio of over 500 measures, roughly about 200 of them are outcome measures. We are looking to expand that side of the portfolio to outcome measures. So it's not like we've got nothing. But in the area of mental health, we don't have a whole lot. I think we counted three or something like that. So there is certainly a need for more, and I'm not aware that we have any measures that really address Alzheimer's specifically, and certainly not outcome measures. So this is part of a bigger effort. Ian will be the project manager for the mental health portion of it. I oversee the entire project. So just keep in mind that there are other aspects, and we'll be sharing things we're learning in all of the different committees so that we have the benefit of the minds of three groups of folks as we're trying to think through the challenges of outcome measurement. Just to kind of show you how it goes, we phased the project strictly as a project management tool, but you can see the types of conditions the main steering committee is looking at, the typical medical conditions, asthma, COPD, coronary artery disease, AMI, heart failure, AFib, stroke, diabetes, CKD, arthritis, you know, osteoporosis, the different types of cancers, you know, the GI, the cholecystitis, GERD, ulcer thing, UTI, pneumonia, and eye care, and glaucoma and cataract. And then phase three is where mental health and child health fall in. And the phases have no more meaning than we had to call them something. We could have called them red, green, and blue, too. You will, if you go to our website, you will see patient outcomes phase three, and that's where mental health will fall into, just as a way of describing it. So that's the big picture of the Outcomes Project. Now I'm going to let Ian sort of focus in on the task at hand for mental health.
All right. And I guess I just want to make sure that you guys know this is a discussion, so anytime you have questions, comments, please feel free to bring those forward as we're going through, so instead of letting them wait till the end. So just kind of diving deeper into the actual Mental Health Outcomes Project, we're specifically really looking at obviously trying to improve quality within the industry here, but also looking at issues specifically within outcomes of mental health, looking at cross-cutting non-condition-specific outcomes, as well as obviously condition-specific outcomes, looking at depression and Alzheimer's, as well as related disorders to that. Another key aspect, I guess, of this outcomes project is looking at identifying gaps. So what is there currently within the outcomes field that's targeting mental health? What would the steering committee like to see? What do we need to see? And then starting to ask the questions, where do we need to go to really get those questions? And I think right now, as we don't really have any measures put forward right now, this is an opportunity for us to really start having those discussions and really engaging those questions. Kind of functioning at the higher level at this point, and we'll move forward when we actually do get measures, but this is an opportunity for you guys to actually kind of direct and show where we really feel like we are lacking measures currently in mental health. So moving forward, as has been noted, really there's only currently 16 endorsed measures through NQF that's actually targeting mental health, and only three of those 16 are actually outcomes measures. So key part of this project is really trying to increase the measures that we have specifically targeting the mental health field. And there's a list provided in the background document, I believe it's on page 12, that goes over some of the current, I guess, process as well as outcome measures that are currently targeting mental health within NQF. So moving forward, this is just kind of a little breakdown of what the current, both outcome and process measures look at. Some of them are, disease-specific, looking at bipolar as well as depression. Those are kind of the two primary ones. And then we have moving down, there's also some process measures looking at assessment as well as adherence. So just to kind of give you guys a background of what we currently have and to start thinking about what we really feel like we need to have. All right, and so I guess probably you guys are well aware of some of the challenges that we face, both looking at, I guess, outcome as well as process measures within the mental health field. Traditionally, I guess, things have focused on looking at older adults within the acute healthcare setting, and sometimes our patient population doesn't always fit that build. They may end up at that point at some point, but they're not always there, so that's a challenge. And then, I guess, mental health is, encompassing. We look at individuals from a disease standpoint, disease process. We have issues with substance abuse and comorbidities, and we have varying, I guess, points of service utilization from within the community as well as the healthcare sector. So when looking at issues of mental health, I think the challenges that we're going to face is that it's very broad, and part of our role will be kind of specifically creating a framework of what do we need to look at and how can we target that. So that'll be part of your role later on this afternoon as we start to look at some of these outcomes. What do you guys feel like we need here? And just kind of moving down, just kind of inconsistent use, as it's been identified, individuals with comorbidities, sometimes the treatment plans aren't always coinciding. We're missing either the co-occurring diseases, the chronic diseases, and we're treating the mental illness, so there's a lapse there. And also sometimes the source of information from the patient population or caregivers. Sometimes it's very inconsistent. We have poor historians as patients or whatever it may be. So that's another key aspect that we're working with. As has kind of been noted, looking over kind of NQF's plans to really increase measures, we're looking at really increasing the value of the measures that we have. I think starting off within the NQF portfolio, there was a lot of measures put forward, and so now I think we're starting to go back and we're specifically looking at outcome measures. We're really trying to increase the value of those and hold, I guess, have some accountability with that. So moving away from just a process measure where we check off a box and we completed that stage of whatever process that may be, to actually having targeted outcomes that not only improve quality but also, I guess, the health and well-being of the patient population or the community. So as been noted, I guess we talked about kind of retooling measures to make them more appropriate to the mental health population. Also kind of looking at enveloping the work of NQF into different activities. We noted, I guess, the National Priorities Partnership, and that's kind of should serve maybe as a kind of a framework for us to start looking at. I didn't provide you guys with the document. I didn't want to burden you guys with a whole bunch of paperwork all at one time and have you not read anything. So I can send that to you later on, and you guys can kind of look at that and see where things may touch with this focus on mental health, or may not be applicable depending on what you guys see. But I think it provides a strong guidance for our work here at NQF, and it'll probably be very helpful within this steering committee as well, focusing on mental health. I guess so. Looking over some issues of within NQF, how do we work and how do we function? There is, a formal consensus development process that we go through, different stages, and we'll kind of go over, the next slide will go over a breakdown of kind of how we function here, what our role is, what you guys' role is as a steering committee, and how that fits into the larger picture. As has been noted, we are a multi-stakeholder membership organization. We have consumers, purchasers, different plans, professional organizations, providers, quality researchers, as well as the community and public health, as well as suppliers within all of that. Function both, I guess, within the private and public sectors, having representation from both. And I guess really the focus is on, the continuum of healthcare. And also, I guess, for this project, it may at some point expand beyond that. I know the patient population within the mental health sector receives healthcare and health services from a wide variety of different sectors, whether that actually be within a healthcare facility or within the community. And so I think part of the steering committee's role here will be to actually determine what is the bridge between the different sectors, how do we leverage our resources as a healthcare industry, and do we have other areas of accountability or do we have other areas that we need to influence? So that'll be part of our focus here on the steering committee. And then I guess at the end, there is a formal endorsement of voluntary consensus standards. NQF doesn't actually have teeth in terms of enforcing the standards that we put forward, so they are voluntary. Individuals, hospital entities, or whoever has the opportunity to actually adopt these, there is a major steward that should be behind each endorsed measure, but it moves forward from there. There's no actual kind of teeth within that. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Please.
Talking about interaction with the other stakeholders, as usual in these meetings. Most of the mental health is in the medical sector. Written about that for decades now. So whatever we do, we need to think about the feasibility, utilization by the medical sector of these things, which is a somewhat different issue, but extremely important issue from its use in the specialized mental health sector. So again, it's not that linkage, that liaison between this group and I guess what you're calling the main group is going to be very important to think how we do that. So it's not sort of dropped on them as news from the outside. As long as it's seen from the outside, we have a problem.
Well, we're actually the main group.
Correct, and I think that's very important. There'll be a lot of issues, I think, specifically, as you've noted, within this population that will cross other areas. And so I think part of my role as a project manager is making sure that you guys are informed of what's going on in other avenues and other projects within the Outcomes Project, making sure you guys are informed, and if need be, we can have conference calls between or have some facilitation between those groups. So, sure, yeah.
Just here's the schematic of the formal consensus development process, and it is formal because it's in order to comport with federal law, as I mentioned, we have to have very specific characteristics of this process. The consensus development process begins with an identification of specific project topics, and outcomes is where it's at for us. So a key component of the consensus development process, or as we call it, the CDP, is the steering committee. And the steering committee acts as the guiding body, the decision-making body, that is really the proxy for our multi-stakeholder membership. So you are representing them. In this particular case, you're bringing a particular focus of expertise along with your multi-stakeholder role.
The Project Steering Committee reviews the candidate measures that have been submitted for evaluation for possible endorsement. You may, some projects have technical advisors or technical advisory panels to assist them in those evaluations. Each project tends to have a little bit different characteristic depending on the needs and the expectations within it. We do have standardized measure evaluation criteria, which we're going to go over with you in some detail. I think that's tomorrow. And ultimately, at the end of that evaluation process, your role is to make recommendations to the NQF membership, the public at large, if you will, on which measure should go forward for NQF endorsement. After those draft recommendations are then subjected to a 30-day member review and public comment period. The comments that we do get in are, we do pay very close attention to, and we will be looking at each individual comment, proposing a response to each individual comment, and we will be back with you to help us do that. Certainly, comments may cause you to reconsider some of your recommendations or revise them or adapt them or whatever. It's meant to be an iterative process with this additional input because you are representing the members. That revised a draft report is then sent to the NQF members for voting, and they do cast votes individually for each of the measures that you recommend. The results of the voting and any comments that come in during voting are then taken to the Consensus Standards Approval Committee. They meet monthly by conference call or in person by meeting. And they review the process, they review the results of the voting, they review some of the major issues that occurred during the project to sort of as a check on behalf of the board that process was carried out, that everybody's voices were heard, and that consensus is obtained. They then make their recommendations for the board, and the board basically ratifies the actions of the CSAC. That's not a rubber stamp because occasionally the board will, decide to go into further discussion or deliberation over something that's been through the entire process. But for the most part, they do rest that responsibility with the CSAC. Once the board has acted and granted endorsement, they are then known as voluntary consensus standards. They get assigned an NQF number. They go into the database in our library. There is also a 30-day appeals process after the announcement of the board endorsement. Those appeals are then heard by the CSAC to determine if any changes in the endorsement decision should be made. All of the measures that are endorsed by NQF go into an automatic maintenance cycle so that they're all reviewed in three years for, are they still pertinent? Are they used? Are they still useful? Perhaps they need revision. Perhaps they, there are better measures out there. So there are a lot of reasons. But it's as I mentioned, the evolution has been relatively rapid over the last few years. And so revision, updating, and identifying better measures is just an ongoing effort. So maintenance is a very critical part of the work that we do. So this is when we talk about the CDP, you all as a steering committee are the sort of guiding decision-making body that works very closely with us as the NQF staff. We'll make sure you follow the process. You'll tell us what's going to happen and make those recommendations.
A couple of questions. Mm-hmm. One thing that's not on the chart is probably among the most important things, which is the input to the steering committee, the results of the call for measures. And, and the experience I've had, and actually I've talked about this a little bit with Helen and with Janet, is that, we're stuck sort of dealing with what's out there, what people submit. And in the mental health area in particular, there's no entity out there that's sort of a steward for the quality measure development. There's nobody that's really seriously funding this stuff. And so it's very spotty. What role do we have in suggesting, coming up with measures?
Actually, a fairly big one for this particular project. This project for mental health and actually similarly for child health,
The reason we're having this meeting with you all up front before we actually do the call for measures is we're going to ask you to help us write it. And that has two roles. One is we need to characterize what we're looking for as explicitly, as clearly, as detailed, whatever, so that we can at least, if there's something out there, we can identify it. We also have enlisted your assistance in getting the word out. That actual call for measures will go out right after the first of the year. So you will also be part of our communications conduit to the mental health community out there, and we will be asking you to, you know, forward the message hither and yon, help us identify who it is we need to really target this message so that if there are measures out there, they can get submitted to the project. Second aspect of this project, which we've alluded to, is the second goal, and that is, what are the measures that need to be identified, that need to be developed? What is that agenda that's specific to mental health? Because I think most of us realize that what's available to us is not what we need. And so the question will be, as we'll talk some this afternoon as we try and characterize what we would like to have and hope might come in with the call for measures, but if they don't come in, that's going to be the beginning of identifying the kinds of measures we would like to see developed in the very near future. So the next time we do this, we won't end up with the very few measures that are probably out there at this point in time. So those are both important aspects.
Also, isn't my understanding that NQF has developed some resources to enable actually to commission measures, so to speak?
Yes and no. Let me just loop back 1 second to the measure development side. So we are actually now instituting a part of our process, which is about identifying measures for development. So we're trying to at least kind of stay ahead of the curve and identifying where there are measure gaps. Actually, this is funded under our HHS contract, a fairly large amount of work being done on a condition-specific basis, at least initially, and some cross-cutting work to see where there are measures, where there are measures that are needed, and really identifying an agenda going forward for measure development. You will be one of those feeders into that list of the measures that need to be developed. And the thought is that we want to specifically be able to, in the future, be less about saying whatever measures come across the transom, but say, in fact, these are the identified measures that need to be developed. There is also a significant amount of money, again, who knows what's happening with health reform, but there's a significant amount of money in the current health reform bills to go to ARC to support measure development. So it's been a big hole. There's not a lot of dollars that go out there to support the development of measures. So we're hoping that will go forward as well. The other thing is that I think we all recognize that, especially in the outcomes field, there just aren't that many there. And I think it would be helpful to conceive of this as really sort of phase one of this work. I think our expectation fully is likely in a year or 18 months where we open the outcomes project and say, okay, based on what we said was needed, what's now out there that we can bring through? So it's very much a period of time where we're going to try to support some of that development. We can't, you know, measure development can be, de novo measure development can be very, very expensive. And I think you really need to be able to have, especially for outcome side with risk adjustment and things like that, you know, the real resources available to make that work. To date, there hasn't been a whole lot of availability to do that.
I think, Joe, you were next.
Yeah, a corollary of Harold's first question, I realize people who are sitting on this steering committee were selected for expertise in different areas related to the project. But I'm also aware that our names were put forward by, we were nominated. And I'm wondering, is this group selected actually to represent specific stakeholder organizations or groups of stakeholders, and to what extent are we as individuals here as individual experts versus representatives of, there were three organizations I think that put my name forward. Do I have some accountability in getting back to them and besides polling them for input?
It's an excellent question. You were, the way steering committees are constructed specifically is to be multi-stakeholder. So we very carefully went and made sure we tried to get, you know, a bit of a Noah's Ark of trying to get most of the major stakeholders represented. We can't always get all of them. We try to as much as possible. You are really here as an expert based on your CV and what you bring to the table. But we are also expecting that you bring that stakeholder perspective, which you bring to the table. Not a lot of people are nominated by three organizations, Joel, so you'll have to work through how you want to split your personality.
I was just getting nervous about that.
Yes.
Maureen, did you have a...
Yeah, there had been a little bit of reference earlier to the notion that we'd be involved in looking at patient engagement perhaps in some ways. And so one of the things I was wondering is, what is the scope of this group or some others related to it with looking at measures to promote healthy behavior? So rather than looking at it from a behavioral health perspective, a healthy behavior perspective, which really cuts across many different kinds of disorders.
So as was mentioned earlier, population health is one of the National Priority Partnership areas. Specifically, one of the goals under population health is trying to think through how you promote healthy behaviors. You know, if there's no reason why if that comes up as part of the steering committee, that would be fine if there are some as related to mental health. But the broader perspective, and actually Bonnie will go through a broader discussion with you later, trying to make the connections between population health and mental health in particular.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Any further comments or comments from our call-ins?
Well, I guess one of the issues that comes up is really we might need some deep background on how are there any objective or relatively well accepted measurement in general of products. I think one of the products with mental health is it's not like you have a glucose level or a lab test, and that may be a first conceptual challenge is to figure out, you know, what measurement in general, forget standards and performance measurement, just measurement of the product itself. Will there be a little session on that at some point in the future?
So, this is Riva. This afternoon what we want to talk about is the types of outcome measures that might be applicable to this particular patient population. And I think it would be perfectly reasonable for you all to broach some of that, is what is an outcome? You know, what would be a desirable outcome? What is important information on the outcome around, you know, mental health, around Alzheimer's disease? You know, what do those look like? I think it's not necessarily clear, and so your question is quite pertinent, but that's certainly something open for this group to discuss.
I guess my follow-up question also is, you know, sometimes we have a unit of measurement, like it's a physician's care or a hospital's care, or a systems care. Do we have any preconceived notions about if you're looking for an accountable party in this for these measures, what that might be, or is that a pretty broad statement at this time?
I think for this first go-around of looking at outcomes measures, I think we're going to be limited by what measures are identified and how they're constructed, and those usually will have an applicability for whatever level of measurement. I think when we put together the analysis of measures we want to have, we could certainly be a little bit more prescriptive about we would like to see measures at this level or measures of this type, measuring this population or this practice or this organization or this practitioner, whatever it is. And but I think it, for the measures that will be evaluated, we'll kind of have to deal with whatever we get. The scope of this project for all of the outcomes is not to limit to any particular setting and not to limit to any particular level of analysis. So these are not just hospital or just outpatient measures. They're not just plan level or system level or facility level. It's whatever would be appropriate. So we really are trying to be as open as possible. And I think it remains to be seen what measures are currently available for us to look at.
All right, if there's no more questions, I guess we'll proceed. So it sounds like this afternoon will actually be very productive. I mean, I guess the line of questions that you guys and direction that we're going so far, I think, will be very good as we kind of work through some of these issues. So just kind of further defining some of the roles of the steering committee. I know we've probably touched on a lot of these already. I guess just kind of highlight some of them. Obviously, to evaluate candidate measures that go against the formal measure evaluation criteria, which we'll review later on. So this is something that NQF kind of revised in 2008, so we'll go over some of the old criteria in addition to the new criteria that have been added so you guys have an understanding of how these measures that come forward, how they'll actually be judged. So another role of the steering committee will obviously make recommendations put forward to, NQF membership for endorsement. And those, I guess, the actual measures that you guys look forward to putting forward endorsement will go to, the CSAC for which they will review, and the co-chairs, will be there to represent the entire steering committee if they're able to make that for that process. So And then I guess you guys, as the measures come forward and if there's any questions or if there's public comments that come up, we will definitely let you guys know what those are, push those forward to you for you guys to review and move on those. And then I know that I guess the role of the steering committee is to act on any direction or advice provided by the CSAC. And so obviously, I guess as had been kind of mentioned, the role for the steering committee is obviously to bring you guys' expertise in whatever field that may be or subfield. So we're really looking to you guys to actually elicit not only the questions that need to be asked, but also help provide the direction of where we need to go. We all don't have a background in mental health, and so we're looking for you guys to provide that. So I guess just some other advice for the steering committee, I guess, to consider information submitted by the major stewards. There's going to be a lot of different information that comes forward. You guys will have the opportunity to review the information and attachments they provide and then act accordingly. I guess at this point, we're looking at drafting major evaluation for sub-criteria. In the criteria. And then another, I guess, role for the steering committee would be to respond, obviously, to any questions that are put forward to you guys. And then to provide comments to committees on measure strengths and a weakness, obviously, after reviewing the measures, you guys will be able to talk amongst yourselves and see how these measures stand up to the criteria for NQF and move accordingly. The role of NQF staff, so I guess those of us sitting over here as well as Helen, and others who are working on the outcome project. So we're here basically to assist you guys into helping you formulate the process to evaluate the measures that are put forward and at this point to come up with a framework to actually solicit what we'd like to see as measures and the direction that we'd like to go. I guess as myself as the project manager, I'm here to assist you guys. If you have any questions, if there needs to be any collaboration between different steering committees, whether it be working with the Child Health Steering Committee or whether it be working with the main outcome steering committee that is dealing with the kind of top 20 conditions, I guess that'll be my role to help facilitate that process and engage any communication as necessary. Kind of further looking at some of the roles of NQF staff members here, we'll be working on the process of actually putting forward the request for measures. We'll be collecting the measures. We'll be categorizing it, putting it into a format that's simple for you guys to read and disseminate. Just maintaining all the documentation of the entire project. As has been noted, this meeting right here is obviously being recorded for public view, and so individuals from within the public as well as members of NQF are able to review and look at the information that we're putting forward and the topics that we're discussing. NQF staff also work directly with the measure developers, trying to solicit specific things that you guys elicit that we need to have within measures for mental health, as well as working with them to try to provide further clarity on if any of the measures, if there's questions, or we have a trouble kind of understanding the direction of the measure. It's been noted, just providing communication, dialogue between different steering committees, as well as you guys setting up that framework. So we're hoping that this initial steering committee will allow you guys to not only be able to meet one another, but also provide us with a framework to move forward, but also allow for you guys to engage each other at other times, whether it be via email or for conference calls that we need to have at another time. So just kind of looking further into NQF endorsement criteria, as I indicated, in 2008, the board of directors kind of reevaluated the major criteria for NQF to use. We'll go over that here shortly. The main point of kind of reviewing and revisiting this major criteria was to provide clarity within those major criteria and strengthen the recommendations and changes for endorsement criteria in order to really achieve these kind of four goals here. One of those being providing a stronger link to the national priorities and higher-level performance measures. So I guess as we've drawn back to that national priorities document is really trying to make sure that our measures, our outcomes here, are targeting that document and are following somewhat of that framework to the degree that we feel is applicable for this project, as well as to provide, kind of as indicated here, high-level performance measures. So we're trying to move beyond maybe just checking the box to actually having strong, significant outcome measures that improve quality within the field. And I I guess, greater measure harmonization here. We're really trying to bring in either whether it be current measures that we do have or measures that are submitted to us. And if they're applicable, make sure that they're going together instead of having multiple measures that target essentially the same thing but may have one slightly different aspect, but make sure we bring those together for greater harmonization. And greater emphasis, obviously, on outcome measures. As indicated, this is really the focus of this project and where we're trying to move to within the field. And for process measures, we're really trying to tighten them to outcomes and process links, so making sure that we our individual process measures within NQF or some that come later on are actually tying into outcomes.
As Ian mentioned, the criteria were revised a little over a year ago for to raise the bar. Essentially, this was led by the Consensus Standards Approval Committee, and every time they meet, they really are focusing in on the criteria. And so we will try and keep you focused in on the criteria, and your rationale for either rejecting or recommending a measure should be based on the criteria. There's no scorecard, so, you know, that we can use to add it up and a certain number needed to pass. However, we do want your recommendations to be based in the criteria. And just show you how that has evolved, because it is important to understand the thinking of certainly the folks on the CSEC and on the board. The prior criteria were the same four, but importance has been more focused on important to measure and report. And this has become a must-pass criteria. And it really has to do with the balance between the burden and cost of measurement. Data collection, data crunching, and reporting is not it's not a minimal resource activity. And so the work should have a reasonably good punch, be important enough to be worth the cost of doing the measure. So important to measure and report has several sub-criteria that have to do with things like, does it address one of the national priorities partnership? Is there a quality problem around this process of care or this outcome? And particularly around the process measures, is there good, solid evidence that the process will relate to improved patient outcomes? So those are the kinds of measures that are likely to provide us the greatest bang for our buck in both raising the bar of measurement and driving improvement in quality. Scientific acceptability is more focused now on the measure properties. It's not the evidence of the measure.
Microphone, please. Importance for whom?
Right. Well, the issue is around, that's why those sub-criteria are very clearly laid out. And it's the importance as determined by those sub-criteria. So if it meets one of the NPP priorities and goals, that's important, certainly to NQF and the National Priorities Partnership, as our role in helping support that. The other is option would be high impact. Is it an area? It has high volume, high cost, high severity. So, you know, high impact. And again, I will agree with you that it is in the eye of the beholder, and certainly when you have different topic areas and more narrowly focused, what's important to this group may not be exactly the same as what's important to another. But again, there are no absolute thresholds. It doesn't have to have a certain number of patients affected. It doesn't have to have a certain number of dollars cost per year. But again, realize that you're weighing it against the burden of measurement, which is not insignificant. And it needs to be very well grounded in the evidence. So those are the evaluation criteria. Some of it is definitely subjective.
But just as an example, because it's something that I've grappled with. On the one hand, let's say you're looking at sort of measures for electroconvulsive therapy, which is a relatively rarely used treatment in this country, versus measures for psychotherapy. Should we care about measures for ECT, given the fact that it's used, you know, maybe on, you know, 20 to 30,000 patients, as compared to psychotherapy used on, you know, tens of millions?
That essentially will be the kind of decision the steering committee is here to deal with. The question is, Will it be useful, valuable, and worth the cost of collecting and crunching and reporting the data for both populations?
And just to add to that, it's not just the prevalence of the condition, it's also the impact of it. So it may be a small number of patients affected, but with a very significant impact on morbidity or mortality, in which case... For those patients, exactly.
Right.
And so that, so as an example, we're doing a project right now on pediatric heart surgery. Not exactly something you would think off the top of your head, boy, now that's, you know, no question about it, that's going to affect huge numbers of people, but it's very high impact for kids who have congenital heart disease. So, you know, I think that's the balancing act we have to go through. So, I was, again, from your perspective where you sit, you know this area really well. I mean, just as an example, when we initially went through this project focusing from with HHS, they were initially just interested in the top 20 conditions for Medicare, and we tried to expand it out, saying the universe is bigger than patients over 65. And so, for example, we added in serious mental illness. It wasn't on the list. It doesn't apply as a top 20 condition for Medicare, and yet obviously a huge number of people, not for Medicare, interesting. With Medicaid, yes, but not Medicare. This is one of those strange split. I saw your face, Richard. So, yeah, this is one of those issues where, we, you know, you have to think really broadly from a different perspective. So whose perspective? We've tried to, for, at least for the sake of the Outcomes Project, think big and help you guys will help us focus.
I just have a question about the conditions for consideration. I know that the focus would be on mental illness, and you also threw in Alzheimer's. Are there, you know, other opportunities to identify neurologic conditions that have a high morbidity, as well as even though the low prevalence rates, such as epilepsy?
At this point, we've expanded the topics that were kind of given to us in our agreement with HHS to expand the mental health beyond depression and wrapped in the dementia. We probably don't have the people we would need to have if we wanted to really go into the other neurologic areas. So I think we're going to want to stay relatively focused within those parameters just so we can and do the right kind of work.
I would encourage us, though, to think broadly about the interaction with other medical and mental health conditions. So one of the areas that I know will come up is substance abuse and addictions. Clearly, there's an important bidirectional role there, and we need to consider it, although not get fixated in one single area.
And along these lines, what about something like delirium?
This is Dan from home or from the office. Yeah, I agree with the comment about, for right now, leaving Alzheimer's. I think Alzheimer's disease is a very important beachhead to establish, and I think it's probably, because I've thought about this, and I think it's probably better to focus on that for right now. Clearly, there are a variety of other neurological conditions that deserve attention in this format, but I think to focus on Alzheimer's disease in the context of mental health, I think, would be a good starting point for further work in that area.
But, for example, I would think with Alzheimer's disease and other associated dementias, delirium is a very common concern or outcome that is meaningful to patients, so that we might, focus in the connection between treatment, for example, side effects and delirium as a meaningful outcome, but probably not the condition of delirium itself and all its manifestations in the hospital, outpatient arena.
This is actually an interesting one. I think that's one of those ones that falls between the cracks to a certain extent because it isn't a classic condition you would list out on a top 20 conditions. I actually think delirium, given the importance everybody has put on it in terms of even considering it as a hospital-acquired condition, at least in the initial round, I think it would actually be something I'd put on the table because I see it as highly linked. And it's not a condition per se, but it's something that will influence that whole 20 list on the medical side as well as a lot of the stuff on this side. So I would think this is exactly the sort of scope setting we want you to do, but if you can make a good case why delirium outcome measures are appropriate, I would say bring them in.
Yeah, this is Dan again. Actually, I agree. I would maybe perhaps change my mind. I agree that delirium and dementia, I think, really do go hand in hand, and to talk about one without the other, I think, would be, would not give a complete picture because there clearly is very complex interaction between those two disorders. I think... you know, it may just be a way to see how this evolves in terms of the scope or the relative treatment of that. And this is a question that I have about how Alzheimer's itself fits into all these other disorders. So maybe putting, I know within DSM, delirium and dementia are kind of go together. So from that point of view, it does kind of make sense to address both of them.
I think you've already said you want to put on the table all those cross-cutting issues. I think that's an apt term for neurodegenerative diseases even beyond Alzheimer's. I mean, if you think about Parkinson's, there are the motor manifestations, there are the cognitive manifestations, there are the mood and behavioral manifestations, and I think that's actually a good model for thinking about how to do mental health measures that are relevant to a whole host of comorbid conditions.
Although we explicitly, this top 20 list does explicitly include Alzheimer's and other dementias as conditions, regardless of the mental, whether there's an associated mental condition. So that in and of itself, but I do think there are cross-cutting issues like delirium that I think fit really well and won't get addressed. And my fear would be otherwise they will fall through the cracks and not get addressed anywhere.
You know, I think if this is the scope of this meeting here, I think delirium can be addressed within the context of dementia as a risk factor for it and a comorbidity of it. And maybe not, I would agree that it probably deserves equal emphasis as Alzheimer's disease, but maybe in this context, it might play more of a secondary role, at least for the time being.
Yeah, a question for the group and NQF staff. This topic could also start to potentially use data from non-traditional sources, so things like foster child placement, incarceration, alternative schooling, those kinds of data. And I was just curious, has there been any thought about looking at some of the social data in some of the other governmental agencies to look at outcomes?
This afternoon, Bonnie Zell, our Population Health Director, will go over with you sort of a intended to be a very wide view of population health and all those potential other sources and places to help you set scope and decide what you're comfortable with. But I think, the reality is a lot of data doesn't reside in healthcare, and so we're comfortable pulling data in. I guess the issue is how much do we want to focus attention on. I think at least in the Child Health Committee, there was an interesting, distinction made between, yes, we wanted to focus on the broader population health perspective, but at the same time wanted to have some level of accountability back to health care for the measures you want to put forward. So something that was completely within the context of schools only wouldn't fit. But if somehow schools related to health care would be, assuming I got that right at the end of the meeting. Yes, okay.
Could you clarify schools would or would not?
Yeah. Schools would, as long as there was some connectivity back to an accountable healthcare system. Yeah.
Measures that would focus just outside and just reside in the school or, some other non-healthcare area, no, but measures that bridge and would have maybe joint accountability or joint interaction or how healthcare should be or needs to be interacting with some of these other entities and organizations they felt was definitely included.
Yeah, let me give you an example. There was a program in Seattle or Washington State on drug treatment for mothers-to-be, and one of their outcome measures was, reduction in foster child placement. So you kind of, mix those two together.
I guess this discussion also made me think about another issue related to this. When we talk about conditions, are we talking about measures for the conditions or measures related to the populations that have those conditions? So, for example, might there be some adjustment to diabetes-related measures for people with serious mental illness that are on antipsychotics?
I think the interplay is very appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So as I understand the agenda, we're going to have a lot of time to really grapple with these questions of scope and vision for this project beginning this afternoon. So great discussion. Do you have a few more slides to give us?
I don't think we need to do, I just want to finish this slide, and then I think we're pretty much ready for lunch. But just mention that feasibility is also one of the criteria, and I know some of you have brought that topic up in terms of, you know, can we even do it? Although at the same time, I think with all of the evolution that's going on around data, better data management, more sophisticated data systems, whether it's health information exchanges, EHRs, blending data streams, claims with other electronic data, we're seeing an evolution in what's possible. And so keeping that forward look in terms of feasibility, and particularly with the emphasis on using health IT, is part of the criteria there. And the other is usability. This is where harmonization becomes important. Can people use these measures? If they're not harmonized and you have a handful of measures on asthma and they're all characterized slightly differently, that's not useful for people. So for those that are going to implement measures, can they use them? Can they implement them? As well as, once you get the information from the measure result, does it mean anything to anybody? Is it actionable on the part of participants in the healthcare system? Is it useful information for patients, families, or consumers, purchasers? Does it help? Is the information garnered important? Is it meaningful? Can anybody do anything with it? Is it really a good assessment of quality and actionable? So those are the criteria. It's important for you to maintain this context. Tomorrow we're going to go over the actual sub-criteria a little bit more in detail to help you understand the criteria which you're going to assess the measures. And it will help, I think, us understand the kinds of measures we will be looking for in the call for measures, because all of them will need to be evaluated against these criteria. But right now, for this afternoon, we're going to be talking about the, you know, how do we characterize outcome measures as it applies to this topic, and how do we ask for what possibly might be out there. So with that, I think.
Over the last, 6 or 8 months, I've attempted to be a user of the NQF site and looking at the measures, and I know part of our job is to look at, think about high-level performance measures, but I wonder what kept NQF from creating some simple categories within this long laundry list of measures. I mean, some of them are like side effect measures. Some of them are a basic database. Did you get the data? Some of them are, you know, sort of treatment evidence and, you know, and other simple categories that you could think about. Why is it listed in a kind of a laundry list that has no simple categories that could facilitate thinking about what do we have? And can you, would you comment on that?
Yes, and I'll just say that that was database version 1.0. We'd never had that before, so actually getting to this point was a big leap for us. It is only at this point searchable by keyword. We are now in the process of trying to figure out, through some work, we actually have a consultant now in the web team that actually now has an external group helping them think that through. Part of what would be helpful from this group as you're building that is what are the appropriate filters you'd want to see. We're at least putting in, for example, just so you know, what site of care it refers to, what level of analysis the measure is appropriate for. For example, if you want to only pull up measures appropriate for hospitals, we'll at least allow you to do that. We're trying to consider the conditions. Should we link it to the UMLS? I mean, there's so many levels of complexity here that I think we're just trying to, you know, advice is most welcome. We're at the point now of doing that. I suspect the new one will be available within 6 months. So they're actively doing it right now, but we wanted to get something out there at least people could begin to search on. And I agree, it's definitely clunky.
Actually, I don't think we really have anyone here for public comment. We've got several NQF staffers, but no, I know. Katie, you're hiding. Come on down and introduce yourself to the rest of the committee. Yeah. Is anybody else on the phone that joined us who hasn't introduced themselves? Or for? Did they open it up?
No.
Operator, do you need to open up any of the other lines?
All the lines are open.
All lines are open, okay.
You've been working.
Yeah.
Hmm?
co-worker.
Are we on lunch break?
Yeah. We're waiting for Katie to introduce herself.
Okay.
And then we'll go to lunch.
I'm sorry for being late, and I didn't want to be rude and come in and just interrupt. So, I'm Katie Maslow. I work for the Alzheimer's Association here in D.C., and I've been on a couple of NQF panels looking at quality indicators, and I'm very excited about this one.
That's great. Anyone else have any further comments before lunch? That would be extremely risky, but... if not, then we have, what is it, a half hour for lunch?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so, you know, just don't be late.
Okay, so we'll start the afternoon agenda. A couple more people will be joining us. So the what we're going to do this afternoon, starting at 1:15, is we've sort of already done the orientation to the project and the steering committee because we were so efficient in the morning. And so we're going to continue with the moving into the framework for the mental health outcomes.
All right, and do we have individuals that are on the phone still?
Yeah, Bill Golden's back. How are you?
Yeah, I'm back.
Oh,
Dan.
Hi, it's Carol Wilkins. I'm back.
One thing I would ask the people on the phone, just from being in the room's point of view, is, especially for those of us who don't know you and recognize your voices, if before you make comments, because you've made some very interesting comments, if you could just say who you are, that would give, you know, that would help us, I think.
Sure.
Wonderful. Okay, well, I guess we'll start then for the afternoon session. For those on the phone, we are going to be just kind of starting off on slide 39, which we didn't finish up before we went to lunch. And it's just kind of providing a brief project timeline for what we're going to be working on in terms of dates. So obviously, we had the selection of the steering committee, and we're having our first meeting right now. And as we've indicated, we're hopefully looking to have our first call for measures in mid-January, and then hopefully have our second steering committee once we have those measures actually packaged and ready for you guys to see and have viewed them. So in April, we'll come together and actually talk over those measures again. So, and as we go through the afternoon, if you guys please, this is a discussion, so if you have any questions, comments, please just engage. So. So just kind of looking at the scope of the outcomes project, just on obedience, just kind of definition of what outcomes refer to. So outcomes refer to changes, desirable or undesirable, in individuals and populations that are attributed to healthcare. Now this is just, I guess, one perspective that we're going with, and I guess it's just kind of wanted to open it up to you guys to see if this is something that was agreeable to the steering committee, and if so, or make comments and go from there.
This is a fairly classic construct and for measuring performance. And but I think the issues around the definition that are important is desirable or undesirable, individuals or populations, and attributed to healthcare. So that's kind of sets a certain parameter for when we talk about outcome measures. All of that is part of outcome measures.
And that's healthcare broadly defined to include health behaviors as well as, or just health behaviors within the context of the healthcare system, as opposed to somebody going to the gym on their own to exercise.
Well, I think that from a realistic perspective, if we're going to use these measures for things like public reporting and accountability of some entity, NQF's focus is the healthcare world is sort of where we're at. Certainly, sometimes those boundaries may can be pushed a little bit with sort of joint interaction between healthcare entities and maybe those outside and leveraging sort of joint responsibility.
Sure. Well, the reason I ask is because I'm aware that some payers are now actually paying for gym memberships and providers are encouraging their use, as part of a treatment plan, and, mm-hmm. and so that's healthcare.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and I think part of what your guys' role here will be to do is to really kind of decide that framework of what are we going to include and exclude within this.
Actually, let me just focus on a couple of other words in there. Number one, changes, and number two, in, and number three, individuals. So that you know, there's many things can change. So if change in what you know, so earlier we talked a little bit about adherence potentially being in there. I mean, that's a change, you know, in terms of whether people are more or less adherent. Based upon some intervention or another, but that's usually considered a process measure. Does the sense in individuals meaning something internal, i.e., physiological? And then thinking about individuals, which individuals? So if you're looking at, for example, an outcome related to the treatment of depression in moms, and one of the outcomes is the proportion of you know of moms whose kids are fully immunized. Is that an outcome measure even though the individuals are one step removed?
I think those are all, you know, really good questions, and they do speak to the scope that we're asking you to really consider. I think that to look at the first question you asked about changes, I think that in general outcomes are felt to be some kind of result. So perhaps changes or results of impact of or something like that is the implication. I don't know if there's a better word than changes. This is the traditional construct. In terms of individuals and populations, I mean, I think individuals are patients as one. And it's issues around the outcomes for that individual patient within a population of, say, a practice. It would be the aggregate experience of those each patient attributed to that practice. Populations also can be looked at in bigger areas, practice population, geographic population, population of patients with a certain condition. So I don't think it's tightly defined. It's a little bit more loosely defined.
Yeah, I just want to make a point if we're going to be talking about accountability of people, that we'd be careful in the scope not to hold people accountable for things that are beyond their control, that when we cross from individuals to populations, a lot of patient behaviors, for example, are not in the control of the provider. And it's I think you have to watch for that when we're asking providers to be accountable for certain changes.
You know, in some ways, mental health also, because of the, the word vagueness or the lack of distinct borders of the conclusion of an episode of care, you know, a cost parameter could actually be, in some ways, a proxy here. You know, the question is, can you duration and intensity of services versus outcomes is actually very applicable to mental health because of the length of time or the number of sessions per week. It's uncertain in many administrative systems. Just what is an appropriate mix of intensity versus outcomes.
I'm also wondering if there should be a word after healthcare, like intervention or action or something. It seems unfinished. You know, healthcare seems too broad. It could just, yeah. And I'm also thinking that changes isn't maybe always what we want. Maybe we want to maintain certain behaviors. So.
There's also this issue of accountability and the tension between what a consumer health plan or employer might see as accountability versus what we as clinicians sort of view as the limits of our accountability. And certainly I think we have to wrestle with that
in a way that not only is true to the three or four stakeholders we represent, but also looking at, you know, what's best for the health of populations and perhaps becoming more willing to assume accountability as providers of care for things that aren't directly under our control, whether it's smoking cessation. I mean, after all, I don't stop the smoking cessation. I can counsel. And, you know, is that a legitimate expectation for providers? And I would argue, yeah, it probably is, whether you're smoking or not, because you can counsel in a way that's either more or less effective, to just take a very particular example, but the one that could be used, I think, as we move forward to consider similar issues.
Yeah, one of the ways that is helpful for me is to think about the fact that as a clinician, I am not responsible for a patient's smoking cessation, but I am responsible for influencing his or her decision to stop smoking.
When we talked about attributed to healthcare, another approach to look at it would be based on some type of treatment option or treatment strategy, and it could be non-pharmacologic or pharmacologic in nature, as an example.
This is Carol Wilkins. I had another question about that attributable to healthcare dimension, and particularly in the realm of mental health, there are also consequences or outcomes that are attributable to barriers or limitations on access to care, and those can be capacity limitations, those can be the failure to assess and identify the mental health condition that is part of what may bring someone to come to the emergency room, you know, 20 times a year for a medical complaint, or it may have to do with policies and practices in the healthcare delivery system that, for example, in some settings might require sobriety as a precondition for treatment so that a person with co-occurring mental illness and substance abuse disorder doesn't get access to or gets kicked out of a treatment intervention or healthcare service. So I guess I'm wondering, this presumes that people actually get care and that that's where we're looking at quality outcomes, but I would presume we also want to look at outcomes that are attributable to avoidable or changeable, modifiable barriers to access.
Yeah, I think the whole structural barriers to healthcare are part and parcel of what we should be dealing with here, particularly in the mental health arena and in individuals with cognitive impairment. It seems like that's often one of the most important things we can do, is to tear down those barriers.
And I guess just to kind of follow up with some, I guess, comments or views that were expressed, Bonnie Zell will be talking, I guess, later on today, really about issues of maybe dual accountability. So maybe it's something that the healthcare sector can also work with or leverage with other resources, whether it be in the community or everywhere that may be, where there's dual accountability within a system. So the healthcare system leverages resources in combination with another entity. So that'll be something that she'll bring up and something that for you guys to discuss later on this afternoon. So if we can move forward on this, just kind of looking at some different domains within a framework that we'd be looking at within the mental health field. I guess traditionally, or things that we've looked at NQF, predominantly our measures have been by disease type. That's one, I guess, domain or way that it can be stratified. Also by health status, whether one's healthy, chronic illness, or special needs would also be another way. Also, it can be, I guess, broken down by the setting of care, whether that be in the hospital, outpatient, within the community, or whatever that living environment may be for that individual. So these are different avenues that we've looked at, and I don't know, I guess, as a steering committee, if you guys have any insight, if we need to be looking at any additional, if you'd like to, restructure, organize, or is this something that's agreeable?
Well, under the rubric of health status, I would probably separate out health, chronic illness from disability. I'm making a distinction about functional status. And I don't know whether you meant that to be included under the rubric of special needs. Maybe you can clarify what you meant by special needs.
I guess special needs, depending on, I guess, upon the situation, could be looking at, does the individual need assistance with any specific area from a caregiver standpoint? Is there any assistance that's needed from the healthcare system in providing care for this individual?
Saying functional status would capture that more explicitly. It's more descriptive.
Okay. I mean, I think the whole concept or model of recovery is something that we should try to embody here, and it's probably equally important in care for elders as it is for those with serious mental illnesses, depression.
I think typically when people think about it, and I guess I'm not sure how you're using the term domains here, whether you're talking about sort of the categories in which we're going to be measuring people, like disease type, or whether you're talking about a domain of outcomes like symptoms, and the symptoms might be by disease type. Because I think that symptomatic status versus functional status, are typically conceptualized as related. And then within functional status, there's different domains within that of functional status. Whether we're talking about social or occupational or other kinds of fact features. The other thing with regard to settings of care, why specifically settings of care as being a domain of measurement as compared to sort of a category in which you may have different measures, but it's not so much a domain of measurement in and of itself. But I can imagine that there might be domains of measurement that have to do with an individual's sort of relationship in one way or another with their environment, both psychosocially and also more instrumentally, so that so that there might be certain psychosocial problems that would be important to look at, for example, homelessness or sort of interaction with the justice system. That might be relevant for different categories. And I think of those things as being more domains rather than settings of care.
Yeah. Just in response, when we're talking about a framework in its most simplistic form, we're looking at being able to look at the various characteristics of measurement, say on a 2x2 table, and say, okay, we have these three measures and they fit into these slots. And then the measures that may come in may fill in a couple other slots. And then we're going to have some empty slots. And those were really the important, and look at those for important gaps of care. So the question is, what are the titles of the rows and columns, if you will, on our grid? And these are the domains that are very, very typical in traditional measurement. I mean, by disease states. It's the main steering committee. It's diabetes, CKD, coronary artery disease, blah, blah, blah. It's disease states. Health status is another one because healthy is usually preventive care. Chronic illness is the same illnesses. Special needs can include disability or some other thing that may be particularly pertinent for certain disease states, particularly children and others. Settings of care is the most traditional way to measure things because, we've got hospital measures, we've got outpatient measures, we've got nursing home measures, we've got home health measures. So that's the most traditional way to slice and dice and look at measures for a group. But these may very well not be the appropriate ones for mental health, and that's the question. That's what we need your help is, what would those be for this particular group of patients?
I think Richard and Robert and then Luke.
Yeah, I see this slide is starting to raise the issue of stratification and risk adjustment. That, at one end of the continuum, we all know that outcomes are multidimensionally determined. At one end of the continuum in our field, I mean, some people start to argue it's almost individual-based, which leads us to a big problem, if it is. At the other end, you've got outcomes that are, so global that people are going to argue forever that around the risk adjustments and stratification of the problem. So one of our challenges is how to get into, meaningful categorizations where there's not an infinite number of categories that are based on individuals, nor is it so large that the usefulness of it is lost in a risk adjustment dilemma. So creating those kind of categories is one of our challenges, I think.
I just wanted to underscore the importance, I think, of distinguishing between
measures of symptoms and measures of function. I mean, when people come to us for care, they're usually wanting to feel better and do better. And that really speaks to both things that we might measure as symptoms that are in the subjective realm and things that we might measure as function that are in the realm of things that might be observed by an outside observer. And I think that it's important to preserve that distinction.
I agree, and I would even take it another step, which is to say, I think we need to be looking at not only the consumer satisfaction, but also the caregiver satisfaction, particularly when we get into areas, for example, like dementia, Alzheimer's, and so on.
I just wonder if the settings of care are just too limiting and foster actually the silos that we don't want to talk about, that we don't want to focus on. And I think care coordination is probably more of the glue that keeps us paying attention to the needs of the patient as they move through all of the settings. So I hope that our model is fresh in that respect, and that we really identify or acknowledge the uniqueness of mental health, which is a multidisciplinary form of treatment.
I mean, this whole concept of providing the right care at the right location at the right time is really where we should be heading. And while I might be able to provide care in a hospital setting, if I can provide either preventive care to avoid hospitalization or perhaps provide the care in the context of the home or an outpatient setting that's more attuned to a patient and family's needs, that's really where I think the field should be heading. If we have this overarching goal, we should be trying to get care more attuned and surrounded by the patient's needs and desires rather than this artificial nature of, well, here's the hospital, but we've missed the whole point that we could have avoided hospitalization in the first place.
But the pieces that get missed are the handoffs from all those settings. And I think that hopefully we'll be able to talk about what our accountability. So I work in inpatient. What's my accountability to the next level of care? I have to have accountability to them.
Yeah, I'd like to echo that and be sort of a little too provocative, but have at the end of our work have people say, "We're the hospital outcome measure.
Yeah.
We don't have any. We're talking about an episode of care. Stop thinking about the hospital outcome. Start thinking about what happens to this person over, 9 months of treatment." That'd be a little stark. I know we're not going to go that far, but I think your point is very good, that if you create these settings, it kind of slots people into thinking of silos again too much.
Well, and it also, I think, gives the message to a developer that, oh, they're just interested in acute measures, which we're not. We're interested in, and we have to find a word, care continuum or care coordination, where there's
transitions of care.
Transition, right. Transitional care.
I think the other thing that I think about is even going back to the component of empowerment for self-care, so that care is not something that we as caregivers or clinical professionals are providing. It's also that which we provide for ourselves.
I also think that if we can somehow weave in the recovery model into these domains, but that's really, as we're trying to bring in other stakeholders in mental health, the conversation that is happening in other areas, along with the person-centered medical home as a setting of care. But if we're looking into the future and thinking about the future, that's really probably the conversation that we want to also make sure we include.
And that's in alignment with other national standards and reports, mental health reports, et cetera.
I think one way that I think that may be confusing us a little bit is that a framework is not the same as domains. And, so when I think of a framework like the rows and columns, it's a way of categorizing different measures that are measuring different domains. And so that, I could see, one dimension being, disease type, including a category that's cross-cutting across diseases. I could see another dimension of a framework being sort of where along the continuum of care something might be most commonly measured, also one that and also having a category that's sort of not specified in terms of that. And then a third dimension being one around specific outcome domains that might include symptomatic functioning, symptomatic status, functioning in different domains, subdomains of functioning, and also incorporating other kinds of issues that might have to do with healthcare utilization and cost and things like that.
Mental health also lends itself to access issues. I don't know if that's part of your continuity of coordination, but there's some interesting data out there that says that if you can't get a psychiatric consult in an ER, you're more likely to be admitted to a hospital. So, and especially in rural areas, the availability of specialty care. So I don't know if that's part of the domains there or whether it's a separate category.
Joel, did you have a question?
Well, I think Harold addressed my main concern, which was that this slide was hard for me to wrap my brain around, and I think the way he described it helps. So I would endorse the idea of sort of rethinking how to describe a framework. That said, I was wondering if it would also be useful to go back to your first principle, Reva, I think, about importance of the measure as being the first cut in determining what's a valuable outcome measure. I think in terms of outcomes, what really matters? It's health status in that it causes, if you're talking about diseases, that the signs and symptoms of disease under that first bullet are causing distress, disability, social dysfunction, whatever, and affecting quality of life. And I think those are the sorts of, I wouldn't call those domains per se. Those are just sort of categories of outcomes to be measured that are of importance. The other one, I'm talking about some examples that apply to individuals, but we also do need to think about examples that apply to the health of the community or the health of the nation. And, if you're talking about controlling infectious diseases that are transmissible in communities, your outcome measure may have to do with something like staying on your INH, that adherence affects communities. That's what I would include under the rubric of health status, both the health of individuals and the health of communities. As clinicians, we think of in terms of what makes a symptom or an outcome clinically significant. When we talk about the word, the concept of clinical significance, it's again what causes distress and interferes with function.
Any other comments on the potential domains? It seems like we need more of a definition for what domains is. Like, if it's a grid, is it just one section of the grid?
What these next several slides are doing is offering you ways you might slice and dice it. So this is just slide one of four.
We have other options.
You
maybe
have other. Right.
We're hoping the next three are more to our liking.
Yeah. Good.
So just kind of moving on, and continuing the discussion that we're having here and trying to really decide what an appropriate framework would be is looking at different areas where information can come from. Information in terms of outcomes can come from obviously the patient or caregiver within the mental health population. As reported by either that patient or caregiver, we can have clinician-observed outcomes. What did I as a clinician observe within this setting? Or we can have physiological outcomes going along the signs of vital signs or lab results. So this is just kind of, as Reva indicated, further just trying to figure out how we would slice and dice what we're ultimately trying to determine and create here. Yes?
Inferred outcomes from secondary data that would be relevant. For example, again, looking to domains that move a little bit outside healthcare, but that might be relevant, again, for kids, sort of school absences.
Mm-hmm. I think very much so. That's where hopefully the discussion will come later on this afternoon. Were there any other questions?
Yes.
Was there any consideration of having a consumer group at the table?
We
have
a consumer group.
Yeah. Oh, today, great.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great.
Consumers, raise your hand. Katie Swin, Maureen Swin.
Great.
We do try. That's a real important stakeholder have at the table.
Okay, so just kind of moving on further here. So this would be kind of looking at some outcomes that we have put forward for you guys to really hash out and look and see if these are applicable to what you feel is pertinent to the mental health population and to move forward. So we're just going to kind of go through the list, and please feel free to comment. We'll try to write down, and I guess this is the point where we're really going to try to take your comments and insights and try to really develop a framework so we can give you guys tomorrow. This is what you gave to us. How can we further work it out and to get what you guys are ultimately going for? So just looking at one type of outcomes, you can have patient function, as we've discussed, symptoms, health-related quality of life, physical, mental, and social. So we have some examples along with that. Activities of daily living, continence, cognition, pain, depression. And so I don't know if we can go through these, or if you guys have any questions at any time as we go through them, please bring those up, and we'll try to.
Yeah, let's try to make it a little helpful. Do we want to separate out
symptoms and functioning?
Okay.
Because they're conceptualized really quite differently, and there are different ways by which it's measured, and so I think that's critical. You know, whether one wants to put health-related quality of life as a subset of functioning or as a separate category, you know, that's I think more of a matter of taste.
I would argue for separate.
Mm-hmm.
And most of my colleagues who do rehab medicine,
right,
would say that you can have somebody who's quite disabled and
mm-hmm.
functioning at low levels and would appraise themselves as having a very good
right.
quality of life, and vice versa, high-functioning people who think they have terrible quality of life. So I think that they're
mm-hmm.
such different constructs in how they're measured and what you get.
Okay.
I think that the cognition in the examples is a problem for people with dementia. This is a measure that's very common. It's in HEDIS and so on. It assumes that you can improve cognition, and so if it's going to be there, it needs to be phrased differently. So maximizing or some word that recognizes that you can have you are going to have worsening cognition in these conditions, but a goal is the best possible cognitive functioning, I guess. So maybe that's sort of subsumed in the function symptoms.
Either said. Now it is. Okay. I think of cognition as being one of the subdomains of symptoms.
But what if you can't make it better?
That's where it goes. I mean,
well, I think that's true for a lot of chronic illnesses mm-hmm. that are, particularly for all the degenerative disorders, arthritis. You can control the symptom. You can prevent it from getting worse. You can perhaps reduce the rate of decline or severity, but it may get worse over time no matter what you do, given current available health care. So I think measuring symptoms, you're right, doesn't have to be about improving symptoms. It could be ameliorating the rate of decline.
But in Alzheimer's and most dementias, you can't do that either. You can affect the person's functioning.
Right, that's right. That's what
they,
right. I mean, that's precisely the reason to separate out symptoms from functioning.
Yes. Yeah.
So that so that one might say, again, if you're looking at the, you know, the matrix, you know, within Alzheimer's, you can clearly you can measure symptoms, but cognitive symptoms related to Alzheimer's, but we may not recommend that be a measure. We may recommend
right.
instead that the cell that has functioning should be endorsed for Alzheimer's, not the cell that has symptoms.
I hear more agreement than disagreement in the end on this one.
This is Dan. I'd like to comment on that. I think the issue with cognition is very
it's very important and very complex, especially because within the natural history of dementia, Alzheimer's and other dementias, cognition plays a variable role at different stages in the disease. Early on, it's the primary factor, but later on in the course of the disease, functional disability and behavioral symptoms often become what is the most prominent manifestation, at least with respect to care and management. The standard, though, is to really just do cognitive assessments at all levels of the disease in standard clinical practice settings. And you know, what's disappointing to me is that there has really been a relative lack of development of appropriate measures for behavior and function that are widely used in clinical practice settings, although these really, I think, could be very useful and should be at least considered as part of what we would recommend.
So when I saw this this chart in the handout that you mailed out, I kind of scratched my head and said, "What are these categories?" Like, I wasn't sure they all hung together. If the top one is kind of patient observable behaviors, and the second one is, you know, measurable physiologic things, and the third one is experiences, and the fourth is utilization. Why in the third one, health behaviors, why isn't that up in the top line?
Yeah, I would agree.
So when I asked myself that, then I wondered, well, what is the underlying basis for these four rows? I couldn't quite tell. It seemed to be sort of, you know, observable experience, tests, objective experiences that are measured in some way, and then utilization. Is that it? And if so, they're not,
right.
They don't all fit in right.
Well,
yeah.
I think the purpose of the discussion is for us to sort of pick it apart.
Yeah,
and to,
okay.
Yeah, it seems to me that a separate category ought to be, as you said, sort of health-related behaviors. Should be a separate and distinct category.
Yeah. Just in response to your question, how did we get here? Actually, when we were drafting the proposal to go to HHS, we wanted to describe that our interest was in being broad, and so we created these bullets. We've taken these set of bullets to each of the three steering committees, and it's amazing the end result for each of them. You're all having fun with sort of fixing them from where we are. So that, yes, I think, Richard, that was the intent. We didn't quite hit it in terms of you're right, perhaps, you know, behaviors belong in the first one. And most of the committees have broken them more apart to be specific.
So it's not meant to be critical of your preparation for this. I know that's what we're here for.
But this is what we're exactly asking you to do, is make it right and applicable to mental health.
Now, I think in the examples piece, I would hit on the issue of caregiver and consumer satisfaction. Satisfaction, not just knowledge and understanding, but also satisfaction with whatever you're experiencing.
Just want to tie this into the patient function piece, which is very important, as well as impact on those who are actually working. So, you know, presenteeism or work productivity, as just calling that out as a separate, or at least alongside of patient function.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of meaningful work, I think, particularly for people with serious mental illness, is very important for us to consider in here.
Any additional insight, or should we try to proceed down to the next one?
Well, are we supposed to now, a question about whether our task is to, whether our task, we're going to go ahead and get started, I think. So if you all sit down and the remaining people will catch up.
So we have, Katie, did you want to say something?
I did. I've been thinking about this, and I'm biased because I think that a very important measure is something to identify people with Alzheimer's or other dementias. But so that's my bias. But if you look at this list that we've got, there are a few things on there that are specific to mental illness. But most of these things are the same indicators that you would use for anyone. I think that that's a problem for us. So to me, my issue, which is the need for identification of dementia, is not just my issue, but perhaps something for the committee as a whole to think about. We are talking about these changes or outcomes in certain people. We're not talking about mortality in general. We're talking about mortality for people with mental illness or cognitive impairment. And it seems to me that we need to figure out how to put this, how to frame it, and in a sense what we're talking about. Because if we're using these kinds of measures, they're the same as for everyone. Almost all of them are. There are a few that suggest mental health issues, recovery, couple of others, but basically these aren't specific at all.
You know, in some ways, I'm going to put my bias on the table too. As a primary care doc, I'm sort of reassured that there's a lot of harmony of measurement across multiple different dimensions of care. And that actually is a potential strength of this effort, that we certainly need to be attuned to concepts like recovery or concepts of minimizing harm and patient to the whole patient that we might not give as much credence, although we should, in other aspects of healthcare. But to me, actually, it's sort of reassuring to see that there's a set of measures that, while may not have been, or concepts that may not have been validated, particularly for individuals with mental health conditions or cognitive impairment, I think we're really just talking about what are the dimensions of care that anybody should be caring about, or the outcomes that we should be influencing. So unless we as a group can find that there are lacunae that are really strictly related to things in SMI, depression, cognitive impairment, then I don't worry about that. But you may see some gaps that we really should be aware of, and if so, or if the group sees these gaps, we really need to pay attention to them.
I think that people with mental illness, people with dementia, have special needs in all settings, and that their needs are related to those conditions, and that that's what we're supposed to be thinking about here. What is special about mental illness, cognitive impairment, dementia in across settings that needs to be measured? NQF has got measures for everyone else. So it seems to me, I'm not at all belittling what you say. I think it's a good point of view, but it's sort of, so we're done. Everyone should get the same thing. I don't think that that's right. I think that the identification issue in the setting is attached to the outcomes. This person has bipolar disease. This needs special attention. This outcome is important, as opposed to this is a healthy, mentally normal person going to school. Great.
So, I mean, I can see, for example, issues of autonomy of patient advocacy, of respect for the individual's decisions that, you know, may be a little bit different flavor, or maybe at more risk. So if you have a patient with advanced Alzheimer's disease or an individual with a very serious mental illness, you know, concerns about their ability to have a self-fulfillment, autonomous, person-directed sort of life may be greater. But I don't see that that really, maybe at one extreme, but that's the same case as somebody who has, for example, advanced heart failure or a person who suffered an MI. But I might be wrong, and that's why we're having this dialogue, so it'd be interesting to hear what others have to say.
I think the categories are similar. I think it's the interpretation that's different, and I think it's okay that the categories are similar. But what people will do with it, how they will interpret what we mean by symptoms and outcomes for symptoms, or how they will give us measures of function, will be different for this population than it would be for the cardiac population, for instance.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say, but you're saying it better. So we need to identify the population in some way. The measures have to be associated with an identified population.
Well, you know, we wouldn't be here if there wasn't a perceived need to apply for some kind of outcomes project for mental health in Alzheimer's, because otherwise they would have decided that the general categories that already exist in the previous groups would have worked for this. Even though we may be reinventing, in a sense, or re-identifying categories that are generalizable across different domains of medicine, something in the prologue of this request for information for people, I think, does need to highlight the fact that while there may be these categories that cut across domains of medicine, this particular request is specifically to address the outcomes in the area of mental health and Alzheimer's and dementias that have not been addressed up to now. And that'll call forth, I think, the responses that we're looking for. So I think a prologue-type statement in the call for responses.
Yeah, I would just like to say that when I think, though, that we do want to, when we think about the population, that the population is everyone when we think about primary prevention. When you look at the bubble diagram, when they look at cardiac, they're really looking at ways to prevent cardiac problems in the first place. So we do have our population where the disease is already established. But really, when we're looking at outcomes, I think we do want to think bigger than that and think prevention as well, so that the population is bigger than just people that have already been identified as having the disease.
That's an interesting concept, but do we have any good preventive interventions for preventing Alzheimer's or preventing serious mental illness?
There are some child interventions, aren't there, about family health and maternal child behaviors. It's not my field, but I think there are emerging preventive, you know, interventions in that area, especially.
When we look at suicide prevention, I mean, there are some preventative interventions if we think bigger than some of the conversation that we've been having.
The only way that I think you could get suicide prevention into a measure set that would be widely used is to say, in people who have X, suicide prevention. So you'd have to name the category. It's not...
Well, sort of like we already have a measure on bipolar disease because they're at a high risk for that kind of activity.
Well, we're back to being on the edge of the population studies, aren't you? Comments, because aren't there things about societal health stress levels and, you know, issues that characterize the society here?
I'm responding more to what Katie was saying, and I think what she might be getting at is this. If you have to call it practice, large group plans, whatever, but only 10% of the patients in Plan A were screened for depression, dementia, whatever, and it's of that 10% that then you figure out what the outcome is to judge the quality of care for this type of situation. But the other 90% could have a lot of patients with those conditions, but they weren't identified. Versus Plan B that has screened 90%, and they have probably a pretty good identified their cohort of patients with those conditions, and then the outcome measures applied to them, and the results are whatever they are. And so I think, Katie, if that what you're getting at is in order to have the most robust measure, you have to be able to identify your patient population as a prerequisite to then measuring an outcome. Because if you really have no way of identifying the population, do you really have comparable results? That screening is not necessarily an outcome measure, but perhaps I can envision a compound measure where the first step is, you know, the percent of your patients that are screened, and of those screened, what outcome do you have? Mm-hmm. Such that you provide the information of how extensively you may have done the screening.
If I remember on the behavioral health tap, this was a really sort of difficult issue to wrestle with, because if you only screen 10% of the patients for depression and you do real well with those 10%, you might be doing far worse than the group that's screening all their patients for depression and yet only gets, for argument's sake, half of them to remission. So it is a very challenging, if that's what you're getting at, I think it's something we need to acknowledge and work on. I'm sorry if I didn't understand.
I think that that's a big part of it, and I think that's something we'll have to think about. But in asking for measures, somehow we'll need to communicate very clearly that this is about measures to measure these things in people with mental health and cognitive impairment or not. If they're just measures, they're just measures. You don't need to say that. So it's a very different call for measures to say.
Agreed. What I heard Tricia say before is that when the call for measures goes out to the field, these are outcome categories, but there's going to be, I keep having in mind that grid of the framework where it's these measures as they relate to depression, Alzheimer's, other mental illnesses, and other cognitive disorders, and that when people are responding, they will be responding specifically to that, both, again, as we were saying, cross-sectionally, longitudinally, looking at measures in those people who have a single episode of illness or those who have a chronic condition or a deteriorating condition that goes over many years. And I think once that's explained in the call, it'll be clear that we're talking about mental illness. I think, even in the outcomes, though, one of the reasons before, as Harold and I and others were talking about disaggregating from the original table we had, patient function, symptoms, health-related quality of life, that really comes from mental illness models and Alzheimer research models. I mean, I do Alzheimer's research, and one of the things we measure, as you know well, is functional status over the course of the illness, and we look at rates of decline. So if we have measures of functional status in Alzheimer patients over time, that's captured under a separate category of function that we've teased out from this. So I think that does apply, but you're right. You have to tell them we're asking about all these other illnesses, including Alzheimer's, including other cognitive disorders.
I'll shut up after I say this, but think about what you just said compared to what Jeff said. So he said it doesn't matter. It's the same measure. I'm worried about the same things in my patients across the board. So I think this is more than just we have a quick answer to it. I don't think we have a quick answer. I think it's something we're going to need to think about in the sending out of the call and in stating the measures, and that it's not unthinkable to say in patients with dementia, this is an outcome. In patients with bipolar, this is an outcome. So actually putting the population into the measure isn't unheard of.
I'm not seeing the problem. I'm just saying these are the same categories, the same domains that we're interested in, but they do need to be applied specifically to the population. So,
When you get down to it, I would think that we're going to also, or the field will eventually, be able to say, well, at this early stage in Alzheimer's disease, focusing on cognition is really important.
But by the time they have advanced Alzheimer's in their last years of life, this may not be really an important outcome to be focused on. We should be more thinking about preserving autonomy and function and blah, 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 safety issues. So, again, I guess I'm willing to let this dialogue stand where it is, reflecting what I think are two important views of the world, not having to have a sense to reconcile them, but being respectful of what you have to say and what it means for our families and patients with Alzheimer's, serious mental illnesses, and so on.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think that you're absolutely right. The call for measures has to be very explicit and clear. And I think part of the charge for this group is to make sure that by the time this all gets put together and the call goes out in January, we're all comfortable with that. So I think this is working toward that process. I do think that what I said isn't really at odds at all with what Jeff was saying about harmonization. So now, wearing my hat as an internist and a psychiatrist, I have to say I too was very reassured by the fact that, for example, we're talking about functional measures which are important for someone with heart failure who's so short of breath that they can't get themselves dressed without assistance. That's really what we're saying is pay attention to the Alzheimer patient who also can't get themselves dressed without assistance, but they can't do it not because of cardiac output and shortness of breath. They can't do it because of praxis and memory and other cognitive, brain, heart. But it's the same outcome, the ability to get dressed, that you're measuring. So that's where harmonization, I think, is a good thing. But we want to make it clear that it applies to Alzheimer's just the same way, different illness, different needs, to be sure. But a lot of it does look like health care in cardiac patients.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the problem is, how do you do, is there a standardized tool for this outcome assessment? It's not currently being done. And are we going to then specify a mandated tool? Anyway, when it comes to Alzheimer's, I'm not sure that would be the disease I'd pick as the for outcome assessment at this stage in terms of other things we can do. But I'd rather stick to something like schizophrenia, where there's something you can actually treat more aggressively than Alzheimer's.
Okay, so if everyone agrees, we will put this. We may come back to this issue of who is the population that we're talking about measuring these outcome measures for. So we're going to put that in an official parking lot that Ian is going to keep. You are responsible for the new parking lot, Ian. Okay, so we're going to try and get through some of these measures so that we can hear the population from Bonnie on the population health. So the next one is, did we do changes in health-related behaviors? No, we didn't. Change in health-related behaviors. So far we have under that patient self-management and advanced directives. Does anyone want to provide a definition or examples for that one? I think we talked about smoking cessation in that one, and I think it's okay, in my opinion, smoking cessation can go in changes in health-related behaviors, and it can go in whether or not someone still has an addiction to nicotine, like in both, I think is okay.
Medication adherence, looking at physical activity, looking at nutrition. Let's see some of the ones that come to my mind.
Alcohol and substances fall into this category.
That's right. I think alcohol and substance abuse fall in the category of health-related behaviors when they're comorbid with another condition like depression or bipolar illness. But they may also be primary symptoms of
alcohol and substance abuse. So there's another example of a category that can accommodate, you know, depending on what the primary disease is, it might fall under one category or another. But it doesn't, again, I don't think the overlap is a problem. I think this needs to be in there.
I feel like there's something in here about patient-centered care that we ought to mention, that there's something about patients. You know, we have a traditionally sort of physician-driven centered care model where the care providers are making all the decisions. And there's a, as you know, a current view that having the patient more involved in making those decisions and taking responsibility for those is an important type of health-related behavior, and there may be ways to
self-efficacy,
patient engagement,
patient problem-solving skills,
care decision-making too, patient decision-making. I think it can.
Probably does.
I think we're just trying to
give examples out.
And maybe risky behaviors would be under here too.
Risk reduction behaviors such as seat belts, safe sex, those kinds of things.
Have we got all those in some place or another? How about the alcohol addiction? Did we put it in both places as suggested? Or does it matter?
Under symptoms, I don't know that we need to put in a laundry list of every psychiatric symptom in the book.
Okay.
But, drinking and drug use, of course, is another. We could list it.
Okay, so are we ready to go on to the next one, which is secondary impact on the psychosocial environment?
Oh, under change in health-related behaviors, diet and exercise, I guess we want to be somewhat complete. Oh, nutrition is there.
Oh,
sorry.
Physical activity and nutrition are there.
Okay, sorry. Got it.
Anything else we're missing? Okay, secondary impact on psychosocial environment. There was a lot of discussion about that, so I'm sure there's going to be a lot of definitions.
Someone explain it to me. I'm still not clear. Where's Harold when we need him?
I think with people were talking about like at school absenteeism. Incarceration, the incidence of children being in foster homes, those type of things I think were used as examples of this in the past discussion.
So is it the name of the category here that's difficult to understand? At least it is for me. I mean, if we called it something like psychosocial impacts or psychosocial consequences.
Social and environmental. I don't know if you need that
cycle.
All right.
Right? Yeah, guys, just throw that.
No, no, we're talking about impacts of, let's say, mental health counseling. So I think that what we're talking about the impact on is on the normal environment, like the social and environmental environment, like school, absenteeism, or whether you're in prison or
do we need the secondary? Does that help?
No.
Okay, then I'm going to get rid of that. So we're talking about the impact on
social/environmental. I have a hard time, teasing that apart from functioning.
Yeah, we have social role functioning where we included work, school, play, family, social interaction. I think, again, I don't want to speak for Harold in his absence, but when he described it the first round, he was using examples like absenteeism, school attendance, and those sorts of things which have to do with the social environment.
Right, but I think we've got that now in the functioning category. I think it's confusing. We already have them up there.
Mike?
We already have them sort of up there. work, school, play, family.
So could we then, would it be the group's wisdom to take the absenteeism, incarceration, presenteeism, and put them up under work, school, blah, 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 blah? Is anybody opposed to that?
Just a comment. When we look at the burden of illness or the cost of illness, and so we focus on things that are measurable, direct medical costs or costs to healthcare. But then these are the components that are, you know, typically viewed as indirect costs, work loss, you know, productivity, premature death due to suicides and things like that, incarceration, homelessness. So I don't know, I don't think indirect is not the right word for it, but it's still within the same category.
Would this be characterized maybe as there could be multiple subcategories to explain function? A little bit, and this one might be a different one, but it's still a part of function.
I think it's different in that we're talking about patient or population outcomes, and I think what you're talking about, George, is more of a system outcome. So, you know, it goes to, like, cost-effectiveness studies and that sort of thing, right?
When this category came up, but exactly what came up was the indirect costs of mental illness.
Exactly.
That's what came up.
That spills
over into these other organizations and social agencies.
Absolutely.
So it has both an individual impact of, gee, I'm not working, I'm not able to take part in my social networks, I might be incarcerated, I might be homeless, and it also has an impact on the population and the effects at the workplace. The indirect costs that actually are the largest impact of mental illness way beyond the direct costs.
I would like to propose that we keep them separate and that under function, the second bullet, that's really, I think the intent of all our examples there was to describe this at the organismic level. How does it impact the individual person receiving that unit of health care, whereas the impact on psychosocial environment really is more effects on society, community, et cetera, which can be measured in terms of costs, as George was saying. And I think that it's so different than measuring it at the person level that we should keep them separate.
We're kind of like second-guessing, what's his name, Donna Bedian? The guy who invented the definition of outcomes. But, I think that if we can add a separate, it keeps coming up that the group keeps saying, well, we want to measure the impact on the healthcare system was mentioned beforehand, now on the environment, on social costs. I think that it keeps coming up, so we need to put it as a separate category somehow and see where it ends up.
Tricia, I wonder if we could, if we change the heading, maybe it would make more sense. And if we said something like social/environmental impact, and then the other things sort of flow more readily.
And add homelessness to the list, because I think that's a nice example of how healthcare outcomes, poor mental healthcare outcomes, affect you when you walk down the street and see all those homeless people, and how it affects society at large. I mean.
Is this also where we would put involuntary conservatorship, those kinds of status, legal status?
Foster care was something that somebody else mentioned, which is similar to that, right? So, yeah, can we put a couple of examples like that under this social impact one? Do we need any other examples? And can we go on to service utilization?
No. Let me go back.
I think we need to put legal, and that there are some.
There are a bunch of.
There are like many, many things under legal. Involuntary commitment, conservatorship, it goes toward incarceration. But that there are legal issues, consequences.
In the commercial world, these measures that we're talking about as being environmental are measured at the individual level as well as at the group level. When a disability management or disease management program works with a person who has diabetes and depression to get them back to work in a shorter period of time, the outcome metric is how long are they out of work. So it's at an individual. When an EAP has to measure what is the absenteeism or have people gotten back to work, it's at an individual and a population level. So let's, and also, I'm glad we took out the term secondary, because for many folks, that's the primary.
So do you agree that it should be, that it could stay separate, though, that the impact on the social and the social environmental impact is separate from the impact on the population?
What I'm hearing, if I'm not mistaken, is that it's in both areas.
That's what I'm saying. It's
okay.
both
there.
At an individual,
yeah.
And it's also at a
right.
Sort of population.
Right, and then back at the other place where we talk about function up in that second bullet. In some ways, we're using the way that people have traditionally thought about functional assessment, which is talking about ADLs or talking about symptom check or whatever disability checklists. And in this bullet, we're talking about more hard numbers, or at least that's the way I would think of, how many kids are in out-of-home placements, or what are the rates of people who have mental illness who are in the jail?
Harold, you have about 2 seconds to take a look and see if you agree. Well, he agrees.
So are you okay with what we did have?
Mikey is smiling.
Okay. You can come back to it if you think about it and have other comments. So we can go on maybe to utilization, service utilization.
The only thing I'd add about social environmental impact is that going back to the DSM-4 problem list is that you could actually extract from that problem list lots of examples that would be useful.
Okay. Anybody want to try for a definition of service utilization?
Well, I think the definition is easy. It's how often and how consistently do they use services. But one of the things I would like to see some sort of measure of is do they keep appointments? Are they no-shows? Do they cancel on the one hand? And then the other side of it is how often are they hospitalized? How often do they use emergency departments? That kind of thing. So it's sort of what do they use and what don't they use?
Yeah, I kind of think of it in this sort of broad notion of resource consumption. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about it not only in the ways we've just discussed, but also medication, durable mm-hmm. medical equipment.
But is that an assessment of the patient's behavior or of that of the system taking care of the patient? I think if you're not careful, you're looking at an assessment of the patient and their disease rather than the effectiveness of the healthcare system in managing the patient.
Wouldn't that be risk adjusted or severity adjusted, and that someone with advanced Alzheimer's might interact with the system differently than somebody who was very early in their disease state?
Well, no, but you're not changing outcomes. I mean, when you're talking about keeping appointments and so forth, or using different kind of services, that's different from somebody, I guess you have a question between the electiveness of what's going on versus the need for or unscheduled use of because of inappropriately managed care.
So it's the appropriate use at the right place, the right time, for the right setting.
Yes, but I think you're going to have to assume that some of these folks with mental illness will be using things inappropriately. I think that's kind of the track record, and the question, I guess, is going to be coming up with measures that are indicative of health system performance rather than the endogenous disease itself?
Well, first off, I think the general definition is sort of appropriate and inappropriate, you know, utilization of health services, you know, and the idea is, I think also it's sort of, you know, in thinking about it from a longitudinal perspective, is sort of like, at, you know, really looking forward to the next level of care, to the next stage of care in that episode-based model that we discussed before. I think, you know, one of the issues that cuts across all of this is, you know, when you're talking about this in the context of a change, and for a lot of these categories, you know, we'll at some point we'll talk about sort of what do you do when you don't have a baseline, and so how do we sort of, you know, how does one capture that information going forward, and plus the whole issue of risk adjustment. But I think that you know, I think what we talked about makes sense. And I think, again, it's for which population. If, you know, if you're holding steady the population of people with mental illness or certain types of mental illness, then that, in a sense, accounts for, you know, the, you know, any kind of comparisons internally among those groups.
I'm not sure exactly where this fits in, but I'm prompted by this comment about to make this on service utilization. In some parts of medicine, although the data isn't solid, quality outcomes may have something to do with how much you provide of that service. That if you provide a lot of it, maybe you're better at it. You know, is there anything that we're going to think about getting at in terms of quality care that has people reporting how much of it they treat? And if you were a consumer and you had psychotic depression, would you feel better if you went to somebody who treated a lot of that than somebody, or if you had an eating disorder? So is there anything in our system that gets that capability, the service volume, the experience of the provider?
The surgery that's done a lot and very important.
Anything relevant to that? I'm just raising it.
There are very few studies of the volume-quality relationship in mental health. I think, actually, Ben Dress and I published one of the few studies on it. There really is a limited amount of work being done.
But is it our role to point out gaps? Is that a gap that needs to be looked at? Is there, or not?
Much, you know, you're assuming that volume is a good, you know, is likely to be a good indicator.
I know many cases where I'm sure it isn't.
Yeah.
But maybe it's necessary but not sufficient. I mean, because I know a lot of other cases where people are going to providers who really have no experience in treating the disorder and their system isn't capable of, if they're not set up or organized sufficiently, to manage what they're treating.
So is part of what you're talking about is utilization of evidence-based protocols?
Related. Those aren't outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Those are processes.
I mean, I think at this juncture, aren't we looking at, for given outcomes, where is the most appropriate use, where there are examples of underuse, where there are examples of waste? So having a patient come to an emergency room for uncontrolled bipolar disorder, which could have been better managed as an outpatient, maybe even in a primary care setting that used evidence-based guidelines, we'd say, well, there's some waste in that interchange.
So I think partly the way this fits into outcomes, Eric, is, at least the way I think about this, is that subsequent to an initial component of care at time one, at time two, people are more likely to get evidence-based care. They're more likely to get appropriate care. So it's kind of a intermediate outcome, you know, thinking of it as one moves across the phases, as the phases of an episode of care. So that's the way I was thinking about it. So in the same way that, you know, of reducing, you know, subsequent hospitalizations, or on the other hand, sort of increasing the use of evidence-based care because because of what was done at an earlier point in the course of the treatment.
Right. So you're less talking about, is is CBT being used for depression, then do you have greater use of ambulatory behavioral health rather than emergency department or hospital utilization?
Or, I mean, for example, I mean, thinking about the whole issue of transitions in care and those kind of things, is it the people coming out of hospital A have a greater likelihood of getting CBT for depression as people coming out of hospital B?
And overall, what is the influence on the episode of care, costs, and quality, the value?
Yeah.
So it will be that doing more CBT by trained cognitive behavioral therapists will lead to more utilization in that box, but in the overall episode might diminish the costs and improve quality.
I read a very interesting case study looking at hospital discharges from a psych hospital recently, and looked at referrals or lack of referrals for medical conditions, which didn't exist. So, you know, one of the things might be if people have medical conditions, is there follow-up utilization for those medical conditions?
I think the utilization, and this may be a process measure, but for improving medication outcomes and particularly medication safety will be tied into the frequency of service utilization and getting appropriate follow-up and management.
And in this category, rehospitalization is often used as an outcome measure. That's a more common.
Also at one time discussed having care coordination or transition of care planning as being under the service utilization category?
Yes, that's a good point. Right? Can we put care coordination in
here? We can. You had it in the parking lot, so we can move it out.
Fire up.
Are we ready to go on from service utilization to the next category, which is direct psychologic?
Physiologic,
sorry. It seems like it's missing a noun. Measures. Thank you. Direct physiologic measures. Okay. Who suggested that one?
That was on Harold's original list today.
Oh, Harold, that was on your list. You get to give us the definition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was
Light, please. Light, please.
It was also on this also, physiologic, biochemical, clinical outcomes, the second box. Right. I mean, there's clearly an overlap with this, but I don't think it's a problematic overlap with the general medical outcomes. So really, because there are none to my knowledge of direct physiological measures for mental health conditions except for sleep disorders. But, you know, I'm hard-pressed to think of any that are directly.
There's some not very good ones
well,
in the addiction area.
GGT
or something like that.
Yeah, but also, urine screening, that kind of stuff. I mean,
So do you
think alcohol level?
Yeah. I mean, so I would include those things. But also, you know, a lot of these are, you know, in the general medical area. So blood pressure, pulmonary function, glycemic control.
So do we want to combine this with general medical outcomes?
I think, again, for the purposes that we have now of trying to get it out to the world, so people don't not think of direct physiological measurements that they can propose.
But there's a difference between general medical outcomes and medical outcomes that are specific to our treatments, like lipid profiles with atypical antipsychotics.
I was using the term general medical to mean non-mental health, not meaning general. That's a term we use in DSM to get away from the use of the word physical.
I guess I'm wondering if you would include under that, sort of the kinds of things that you would want to measure if before and during a particular treatment, lithium levels,
Yeah. Electrolytes, EKG, if you were going to have somebody on
liver function.
I mean, I'm wondering if
diabetes.
If that would come there, or if it would come under adverse events that you're trying to avoid.
I think, you know, some of those may come under safety, some of them may come under adherence, and that's okay. Again, we've captured this broadly, and we can worry about, we don't even need to feed them in categories later. We just want to bring this in.
Right, but I don't think we have anywhere written down that I see this issue that a few people have said now about things that you measure because you might be on a psych drug, for example. Do we have that?
So medication monitoring.
Those are process measures. They're not the outcome of the med treatment. They ensure the safety and the appropriate dosing, but they're not the outcome.
Adverse effects are outcome.
Well, we don't need them. You're looking for, but they might be an outcome.
Do we want them on the list or not?
Either way.
Do we want them in one of these categories? I just didn't see that was down anywhere. And three people mentioned, you know, liver profiles or, you know, whatever.
I think you're in this. I would see this as a CV, you know, a cerebrovascular event with an antipsychotic. Cerebrovascular event would be the bad outcome of using drug therapy, or metabolic syndrome secondary to antipsychotic treatment, or death.
Yeah, I think we're talking about whether you measure it versus, you know, the measure of, you know, of glycemic control
as a measure of outcome, as compared to whether or not you're measuring it.
Okay. So we have it enough for everybody?
And what about something like BMI? Would that go into this category?
Yeah.
Body mass index, would that go in this category or... Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about, the next one is patient. Are we ready to go on to the next category?
Mm-hmm. I would suggest this, that a future measure, pharmacogenomic indicators, will probably be important, probably not at press time, but they're coming.
Under direct physiologic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pharmacogenomic. Dr. Reddy?
I'm not a doctor.
It's more of a process measure.
Yeah, unless you're planning on changing it.
Genetic engineering.
No, that was not my suggestion. Although that would be cool. But as a measure of getting the right drug therapy versus not, and being able to have appropriate selection up front and not a reactive position.
Yeah, but I think from that kind of point of view, it's
process.
Okay.
Weaver's got it down, right?
I'm leaving it there for the time being. You can erase it later. I'm just pleased I sort of got it up there.
Okay. All right. And patient caregiver experience and satisfaction.
Anything else?
Does that say it all, or do we want to say some examples? Or?
We already have the ECHO study in there as one of them. It's already in the ECHO assessment.
So we probably don't need any more explanation or examples of that one. Okay, we can move on to the next one. Okay, safe living and environment. Anything to add to that one? We have talked about some of those things before.
Safe environment, just so I'm sure what everybody's talking about.
Okay, who suggested this one? Oh, yeah, copy that.
It's on your slide on...
Yeah.
It was on slide 44.
Looks like it fits in someplace we already covered.
So do we want to just move that one up into the
social environment?
Social environmental impact, and I'd use it as an example.
An example under social environmental impact. I mean, the examples that were in the slide. I'd put that on the social.
Okay. So we could... Make a note that we want to add some examples from slide 41 to that.
For family violence.
To that one, too.
Slide 44.
Oh, 44. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Maureen.
Yeah.
We remove it as an individual.
Yes.
thought.
Yeah, it's just the third one down on slide 44.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And is that where something like homelessness would go?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've already got it. Okay, the next one is patient safety, adverse effects, medication side effects, and complications. Do we need any more to that one? Suicide?
Yeah, I think suicide would be a nice one to include in mental health. I mean, is it a patient-oriented outcome? Suicide attempts, I'd say probably it is.
I look at attempts and completions.
You could just generalize it to self-harm. Okay, self-harm. Excellent.
Yeah.
I'd rather see self-harm be separate from suicide attempts and completions.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're talking about measuring alteration and risk and protective factors for self-harm.
Aren't all the other sentinel events in here, too? You know, restraints and elopement, restraints and seclusion, utilization.
In the addiction area, we talk about reductions in risky use, which could be needle sharing or drinking and driving.
God, I have dyslexia.
And things like falls. I mean, falls are certainly things that are being looked at in other settings, but clearly in an inpatient setting, falls is important.
I think all the Alzheimer's
disease. Again, the things that we're measuring there are things that the health system can do to reduce the risk factors, the modifiable risk factors that lead to falls, to suicide, et cetera.
Does delirium come in here?
Yeah, I think there's literature on prevention.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, measurement is going to be the challenge.
Well,
I'm thinking particularly in your elders who were giving, you know.
Absolutely.
What about medication errors? I don't know if that's something that falls under there. The other thing about, I think we talked about this earlier around having some infrastructures in place such as health information, HIT, available to reduce some of those.
That's a process measure.
Would that go under a process measure?
I think that's the means to these, to reducing these outcomes, bad outcomes.
Where would people see health literacy fitting in there? That could be patient experience. It could also be patient safety. But
there's also the whole issue of cultural factors in care.
Uh-huh. Health literacy.
Caregiver experience.
Health literacy and cultural competency. You would put those there?
Yeah.
I'm fine. I think
IAS sits under patient caregiver experience.
We just might want to elucidate patient experience a little bit more with those two.
Mm-hmm.
And cultural competency.
I mean, so it's culturally appropriate care. Presumably,
right.
That's an outcome that matters to patients.
Mm-hmm. Right, that the patients perceive that they were, that the caregivers, that the providers were attended to their cultural needs.
Mm-hmm.
And cultural
and recognizing the patient can't read the instructions on the bottle that
right. You
handed them. Yeah.
Yeah, things were too complicated to them.
Okay. Do we need any more in that category? The next one is patient safety, adverse events. Oh, we just did that one. Sorry. Where are we? Non-mental health medical outcomes.
I think we at least need a parens that says general medical. I know you don't like that, but I think that the field, by and large, I don't know, if I saw non-mental...
Well, you know, when we were doing DSM-4, we had a sort of an internal contest to come up with a better name for mental disorders and a better name for physical disorders. And nobody won for mental disorders. But for physical disorders, we sort of came up with a, you know, a half-assed general medical condition.
We just need to maintain the mediocrity here.
So do we need any... any particular?
Well, actually, I'm assuming substance conditions are part of the mental health thing.
Yeah, no, I was just referring back to the ILM title.
Yeah, mental and substance use. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, we should be explicit actually throughout this that we're talking about mental and substance use conditions throughout, and so this is non-mental health / substance use medical outcomes or general medical conditions, whatever you want to call it. But here we're talking about all comorbidities, all general medical comorbidities, as well as prevention of general medical comorbidities. So, you know...
I thought this category emerged to distinguish it from medical outcomes like diabetes from antipsychotic use was a medical outcome associated with mental health treatment versus... hypertension and people's inability to achieve control of hypertension because of their behaviors or their lack of medical, care involvement because of their condition.
And maybe
isn't that why it emerged?
Sometimes you have lousy glycemic control because you're on an antipsychotic drug. Sometimes you have lousy glycemic control because you're not on an antipsychotic drug and you're so disorganized that you're not taking following your diet and taking your insulin.
I think there's three
or other possibilities.
I think there's three broad categories in this. I mean, number one is essentially the secondary consequences of treatment or of having the condition that makes it more likely that you're going to have more difficulty controlling the outcomes. Number two is the fact that you have a mental disorder and you also have diabetes means that there ought to be some mutual responsibility between the mental health side and the general medical side for responsibility for both the depression and the diabetes.
Right, I would echo that. So much. Yeah, take another shot at it. We all know.
But let me finish. And number three is the preventive side. So that, if you have a mental disorder, you ought to be assessed for the extent to which your providers are providing you with all the expected preventive services.
Rich?
I'm sorry for interrupting, Harold, but the huge number of people with serious mental illness who don't get medical care.
Right.
Because they don't see anybody. That's what I think maybe we're getting at. So I think Harold did cover it by the category he mentioned.
The other example that I think should go in here, since we made a point before of separating out symptoms and functional status, is excess disability, meaning the COPD-er who's got such a bad anxiety disorder that they're... dyspnea is made worse not so much by their pulmonary function but by their anxiety, so they can't walk more than a block.
Good. It seems like this would be a great area to get some unique composite measures that really look at the medical and the mental together rather than separately.
Let's also add dental.
Yeah, dental is a great example.
Yeah, excellent.
Good point.
Okay, are we ready to go on to the next category, which is mortality?
Not much more to say about that.
Would someone define this?
I like Sheila describing it as a physiological outcome.
Actually, while we're on dental, I like that so well. I would put it also under the non-mental medical outcomes.
Yeah, no, I thought that was the intent.
It ended up in composite measures.
It needs
to be in both. That's great.
I think we all understand mortality.
Okay, how about recovery?
If in denial.
How about recovery? Did recovery recovery already in the sort of workplace, school type
Well, I think there is one. a kind of ethos about recovery. That it's probably Joel keeps shutting it off, and then.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
I mean, I've got a model here of the recovery model
that I
brought, and it's got a lot of specific elements that we either want to include explicitly or not.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's built on shared decision making. Some people, like Bob Drake, don't like the use of the word recovery; prefer shared decision making. But it's, there are, sort of elements. In terms of sort of hopefulness and optimism, associated with outcomes that would be relevant.
I mean, if you look at least this model that I pulled: hope, spirituality, choice, wellness, understanding, trust, respect, confidence, and then treatment support, family and friends, peer support, meaningful work, income support. I mean, I can just hand it over. But
there are outcome measures in terms of whether people are meeting their sort of self-directed wellness goals.
Right. You can measure satisfaction with work as an example, or you could measure how much income support is needed, SSI, and so on and so forth. So each one of these could be translated and sometimes are in these programs that are based on a recovery model.
I was also looking again at the famous slide 44, health and well-being, and they talk about absence of disease or reduction in disease status or patient-reported happiness.
Yeah, I mean, there's more than a little bit of overlap with health-related quality of life, but that's okay.
So did you want to add some words from that slide 44 in the recovery one? So Reva, can you just note slide 44 on the recovery one, and we'll take a few words from that slide under recovery?
Fourth one, health and well-being on slide 44.
Okay, the next is incidence and prevalence of disease. Oh, I think I suggest.
So is this beyond what we have up in non-mental health medical? And if so, what is implied here?
There's a measure that Catherine Rost has been pushing of treated prevalence. Are we meaningfully treating the proportion of people with major depressive episode, and are they engaged in active treatment as an alternative to the AMM measures?
Although I'm not sure it's an outcome measure.
I think it actually is the way that Tricia was presenting it. The outcome is. And it's kind of like the Dee Eddington. Are you reducing the prevalence of people with that condition over time? But this is definitely a population based. It's really hard to do this at a personal level.
It's hard to imagine any feasible possibility of truly measuring that. I mean, we may be having people bark up for the wrong tree because it's.
At a population level, I think it's reasonable for holding a system accountable for treated prevalence, but I don't think it makes sense at a individual level.
Right, but treated prevalence is not the same as reducing the prevalence. Because if you're measuring treated prevalence, you want to increase the treated prevalence. That's what you're holding accountable for.
Right, but that is one of the things that Dee is trying to push.
I think what Dee is trying to push is reducing the prevalence, assuming you actually have a valid measure of prevalence.
True. Or risky.
What Catherine is talking about is, are you getting, of the proportion of your enrollees, do you have any sort of reasonable proportion that are actually getting treatment?
Mm-hmm. Those two very different things.
Yeah.
At the facility level, you can look at incidence of things like depression, anxiety, delirium, right?
But the problem here is that the reality is that given the inadequate access to care, and that in most cases you want to see this increase, But, you know, if you really had valid measures at a population level, we really would want to see a decrease.
But, I mean, we have analogously a big effort about hospital-acquired infections. What if we had a big effort around delirium, which is a huge problem in hospitalized patients, with, particularly our elders with cognitive impairment? Seems like, you know, that'd be just as valid for our interventions as hospital-acquired infections or ventilator-associated pneumonia.
We worked on a measure like this a long time ago on nursing homes and reducing the levels of depression as measured in the, whatever it is, the semiannual report, and that a measure of nursing home effectiveness was a reduction in the proportion of people with depression who were measured from
Right, but that's
a population.
But that's because you have universal mandated assessment.
That's right. Right.
Yeah. So it has to be in an environment with universal mandated assessment.
You know, a secondary one would be in a company that incents using an HRA. And do you have reductions over time or smoking
other
conditions?
It's reasonable to consider that.
Or just look what has happened with Jayco and pain. I mean, you know. Now you can't walk in the hospital as a visitor and not say, "Oh, you had paid. I'll rate it from 1 to 5.
I think that since our purpose is to elicit feedback, if we think that you know, the measurement of incidence of disease is important, then we can look for those kinds of that kind of feedback. Maybe it may be
reasonable.
Surveys.
If a health plan wanted to do some kind of survey, or if it's, you know, like nursing homes, that's a good example. This thing just made me also think about, we might want to say up at the very top where we have, you know, symptoms, is to put something about improvement/remission, because I think that's one of the issues in terms of thinking about this. And a lot of the push is that towards remission.
Yeah, now that we've generated this huge list,
right,
we've got things we've called maybe process outcomes. Now we have this term intermediate outcomes, which kind of implies that there's enough that you can keep going on that spectrum to high performance outcomes. I'm not sure what the terms are. I wonder whether there ought to be anything in the directions that give this sense of this kind of evolution of outcomes from process to intermediate to high performance, because otherwise a lot of people are going to cascade us, I think, with lower-level process measures, which I think we have enough of already, and the real harder conceptual problem here facing the field is to get to higher-level, not sure what the right term is, outcomes. And I don't want us to set ourselves up for getting people to spend a lot of energy identifying more, I know it's the right term, but lower level process, intermediate outcomes that might have some validity. They're measurable. You can do them, which is why they're used.
Although, Rich, I think you have to realize that for the purposes of a call like this, the only things that are really eligible to be submitted are things that have been tested essentially, or that have been sort of well thought through. It's not, and so that you're only going to capture sort of the, you know, things that are out there. I think that by having a very broad, you know, I don't think it, you know, I do think you want to emphasize, you know, the things that are more outcomes, because that's the focus of it. But I think by, you know, but ultimately when it comes down to what we're going to get in, my guess is that it's going to be really a quite limited sort of batch of things that are appropriate. And a lot of our report is going to be around what needs to be done.
Okay. Fair enough.
I don't think people are going to be just, you know, actually just in the few weeks of when this call for measures is out there, it's actually going to be developing new measures. Mm-hmm. They're going to look and see what's on the shelf.
I just wanted to say I think we need to clarify that incidence/prevalence of disease, because I'm not sure people that receive it will know what disease we're talking about, because above it we have the non-mental health. So I think just clarifying that to make sure that they know we're talking about mental illness there, at least I think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
isn't as prevalent as mental / substance use
disorders.
So we've. Does anybody want to say anything about end of life or palliative care besides what's there?
Actually, if I wanted to go back to the incidence prevalence discussion, when we talked about screening for mental illness, I know that that's more of a process-related measure, but it might be important to focus on screening of mental illness and general medical conditions. For instance, those with epilepsy or after acute MI, you know, the incidence of depression is quite high. So just having applying that as screening for mental illness in general medical populations.
So what you're advocating is enriched populations doing the case finding, and is that really an outcome? It may be an intermediate. Does a patient really care about that? No, they care about whether the MI is better or their depression is better.
Right. And maybe
what do people feel?
Well, yes, people, I can stroke. What's your outcome of with your post-stroke depression patient? Well, I guess it's pretty good, but we don't have any of those patients. And I look
it's
at the
chicken and egg issue.
Have them.
Okay, are there any other comments on any of the measures? Not that this is the last opportunity, because Ian and Reeve are going to write this up, and we'll have another crack at it tomorrow if we'd like to, once we can look at it. And Bonnie has also graciously agreed to move her presentation until tomorrow because we've gone so late. Thank you, Bonnie. And it is past the time when we said we were going to adjourn, which was 4:30, so it's 4:40. So I think we'll adjourn for the evening, right?
We still need to capture the suggestion on that third to the last bullet. That should read incidence / prevalence of mental and substance use disorders.
Did you get that, Rita? Okay.
Evidently, do we have to ask for public comment?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Is there anybody on the phone or any National Quality Forum members or public that have comments at this point? Okay. I don't think we have any of anybody on the phone. It's good to ask. Thanks for the reminder. And what time are we convening in the morning? Okay, so 8:30 a.m. here again, Continental Breakfast, and the meeting will start at 9, and Bonnie will do her presentation on population-based health. Thank you.